Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 17 of the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am Sean M. Myers, the M standing for Man-Bat, one of your hosts. And with me as always is my co-host and Bat cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
I'm great, Sean, but when we're done recording, I got to run over to the gardens and gather up great bat aunt Uma. Seems she's been talking to plants again. How about you?
Well, I was just talking to great bat uncle Jim, and he was really making me laugh. This month, we have another special guest star, Martin Menza. How are you today, Martin? But more importantly, what special dish did you bring to the reunion?
I am doing great, cousin Sean. Thank you guys for having me. Glad to be here today with you both. I brought with me a large Tupperware of my party go-to pasta salad. It's made with spiral pasta, nice. A bag of those frozen carrots and peas. You know, those carrots that are cut into the teeny tiny little squares. And it's all tied together with a healthy amount of creamy buttermilk ranch dressing.
Wow.
Delicious.
Paul, why don't you tell our listeners what our show is all about?
Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978. And then it rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, as of this issue, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Ragman and the Demon. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion.
So, Martin, before we get started, tell us what your relationship is to the Batman family. How did you get into the book, and who is your favorite family member?
Okay, well, my relationship with the Batman family title goes back to issue number 3. I know a favorite of you guys, The Island of 1,000 Thrills, from the fall of 1975. I bought that one off the spinner rack at a local drugstore that sold comics near my house about a half a mile. I was instantly hooked with this book, and I continued to pick it up with issues 4, 5, 6, and 7. But then issue 8 eluded me until I found out a classmate of mine had it, and I had to trade some comic books to acquire that one. After getting number 9 and 10 off that same newsstand, I decided I'm not going to miss another issue. So I mailed in to subscribe to the book, starting with my issue 11, and I was over the moon when I got a notification that the title was switching to a dollar comic, because I'm like, hey, I got a dollar comic subscription when I was doing a normal one, so I was very happy with it. I stuck with it through all the rest of the dollar and Detective, and probably well into when Detective went back to normal. So, and my favorite member. Gotta remember that one. I'd have to say Batgirl for a couple reasons. First, I grew up on those reruns of the Batman show from the 1960s. And like many, I had a huge crush on Batgirl as portrayed by Yvonne Craig. And also, Babs and I share something in common. We both have had careers as librarians. She started out as one before becoming a congresswoman. My current career now is a public librarian after spending about 3 decades in software development and support. So I got to say Batgirl.
Yay. I work in a library. We love our public libraries. Bat Cousins, if you don't make use of your library, check into it. They have free streaming services that you can use. You can download books. Oh, it feels like I'm at work. You can download books, audio, movies, anything. So even if you're only doing that, check your local library. Thank you, Martin.
Yeah.
Now, Martin, I do have a question about your subscription. So at the time, like this time period, I had a subscription to The Flash, and it would always come in a brown wrapper. Was that the same thing?
Yes. And if you were like me, Sean, I knew when the books were coming, so I would run out as soon as the mail came, because I did not want it sitting out in that mailbox, especially during those Western New York winters. I did not want them out in the cold and the snow that long. So you hope that they came flat. And the days that I was in school and I knew where they were coming, I would, like, I want to make sure to rush home to grab that mail because I knew I wanted to get it.
And I don't know if it overlapped at the same time, like when Batman Family stopped and it went to Detective. Did they just pick up Detective for you and switch it over automatically?
Ooh, so right. I was notified that it said the title you're subscribed to is currently being canceled. However, it's going to be continuing in Detective. So we're going to continue your subscription there. And that wasn't the first of my subscriptions it wouldn't be, because I had a subscription, and I'll talk about later, to Secret Society of Supervillains. And when that one died, I can't remember what they moved it. I think they checked and said, well, you've got a subscription to Justice League, so we're just going to tack it onto there.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure Bob Rozakis was probably the ones that was sending the letters on those things too.
At the time I had subscriptions to two comics, The Flash and Best of DC Digest.
Oh, very good. I think I had Justice League and I might have had one other.
Bat Cousins, if you subscribed at the time to any issues, let us know, because it's always cool to hear about that.
Absolutely.
Now, because I have been so inspired by the history lessons of Bat Cousin Professor Paul, I now have my own history lesson to present. In honor of Batman Family 17 being the first issue that went to Dollar Comics, I have the story of the rise and fall of Dollar Comics. And when I say research, basically I'm cherry picking quotes from one article from Back Issue Magazine. and then I do have some other stuff, but like the real information is coming from issue number 57, which is July of 2012 from Back Issue Magazine. And the title of the article is, I'll Buy That for a Dollar, DC Comics, Dollar Comics. And it's by Max Romero. Hey, Max, how are you?
Hey, we know that guy.
In 1977, DC Comics was on the unavoidable verge of raising cover prices to 35 cents. So DC publisher Jeanette Kahn had an idea. Charge readers a dollar instead. At the time, the average comic came in at about 32 pages total, with 17 of those being story pages. And then Jeanette Kahn says, when I came to DC in 76, one of the first things that struck me was how underpriced comics were in comparison to other comparable items whose purchase price had kept pace with inflation and changing times. This observation was echoed by retailers and wholesalers who said we were suffering staggering returns because comics, priced then at 30 cents, weren't treated with respect of magazines with their higher cover price. The dollar comics line was exactly what it sounded like and more. Comic books that offered readers an average of 64 pages of story for $1, while at the same time standing a full quarter inch taller than the average comic, just to make sure they stood out on the newsstand racks. And while the actual page count would fluctuate over the years, some issues would boast as many as 80 pages, readers would generally get the equivalent of four comic books worth of stories for the price of three. After launching the line in 1977, Dollar Comics went on to encompass familiar titles, special issues and annuals, and even two original series over the next 6 years. It all began with House of Mystery number 251 and Superman Family number 182, which hit the stands with March 77 cover dates as enormous statement-making 80-page debuts. They were swiftly followed with the equally hefty GI Combat 201 and World's Finest Comics 244, both April 77. Continuing the strategy of converting already existing anthology titles to the Dollar Comics line. Joined later that year with an issue of Superman Spectacular, which is October 77, an unnumbered title that was also under the DC Special Series, reserved for one-shots and special issues, the new line was gaining traction and soon expanded. The Batman Family was added in May of 78 Yay! With issue 17 and was joined in June of that year by Adventure Comics 459.
Loved Adventure Comics. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the dollar comic line was doing well enough that DC was able to drop all advertising from those titles while adding attractive wraparound covers. Two original anthology series created under the Dollar Comics umbrella debuted in 1979. One was a war comic called, appropriate enough, All Out War, and has the distinction of introducing the world to Valoric, better known as the Viking Commando.
Yeah, Viking Commando.
The other was a science fiction book with the suggestively futuristic title Time Warp. And now this is me, Sean, speaking. Time Warp is one of my all-time favorite comic book logos ever. I say it every time. There is such a sense of motion in that logo. I absolutely love it. One notable thing about Time Warp and All Out War was they were both published in the aftermath of the DC implosion. In spite of its relatively higher price, the Dollar Comics line was almost completely unscathed by the implosion. Now, this next part I highlighted in orange because it has to do with us. The only victim, strangely enough, was the Batman Family, sort of. With DC trying desperately to trim the fat from its now bloated catalog, the decision was made to give the axe to Detective Comics, the publisher's longest-running title and the inspiration for its very name. After others in the office fought to save Detective, It was instead merged into Batman Family and became Detective Comics starring the Batman Family, a move that would keep the legendary title on the stands until 2011. But Dollar Comics still had to pay a price, and page counts dropped while ads again found their way into the books. The line continued to show a surprising resilience, however, and after taking time to recover, the titles managed to publish ad-free again in 1980. Cancellations, however, were on the horizon. Time Warp was the first, although before long, the entire Dollar Comics line would follow the fate of Time Warp. Cancellations, replacements, and in some cases, titles being scaled back down to the average price and page count eventually led to Dollar Comics quietly fading away after 6 years on the racks. It was, Jeanette Kahn says, only a matter of time. Despite the opinion wisdom of the comic book marketplace, it didn't matter what price our comics had. Whether 30 cents or a dollar, the returns were all the same, and we were printing four comics to sell one. These economics inevitably doomed Dollar Comics, and it wasn't until we'd grown the direct market and could print a title to order that we were able to price a comic book at a dollar and make a huge success of it. And that's where the article ends. I have a little bit more cool things about Dollar Comics. So I'm going to read off the list of all of the Dollar Comics and not each issue number and everything, but I'm going to read off the titles. And pay attention, cousins, because I have a quiz for you as soon as I'm reading these off. Okay, so Action Comics, Adventure Comics, All Out War, All-Star Squadron, Batman Annual number 8, Batman Family, DC Comics Presents Annual number 1 and 2, certain issues of DC Special Series, and we'll get into that in a minute, Detective Comics, The Flash number 300, GI Combat, Green Lantern number 150, House of Mystery, Justice League of America Annual number 1, Legion of Superheroes 294, and two Legion of Superhero Annuals, The New Teen Titans Annuals 1 and 2, The Saga of the Swamp Thing Annual, Sergeant Rock Annual 2 and 3, Superman Annual number 9, Superman Family, Superman 3 Movie Special, Time Warp, The Unexpected, The Warlord, World's Finest Comics. So I'll tell you right now, counting the issues of Batman Family and Detective that are together, that ran for 19 issues. Mm-hmm. So I just read off all of those. What do you think had the longest run as a dollar comic?
Wasn't Superman Family?
Superman. Superman Family is second with 41 issues.
Oh, wow. Was it House of Mystery then?
No. So second was Superman Family at 41. World's Finest had 39 issues.
Okay.
That's third place. Batman Family and Detective together is 19.
Right.
DC Special had 11 issues, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The number one title with the most dollar comics is GI Combat.
Oh, wow.
59 dollar issues.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, that is amazing. So now I'm going to make a really quick run. DC Special Series, I think Rob Kelly has said, like, this is like the most unusual series DC ever published, because there were a lot of dollar issues, there were special issues, there were tabloids, there were digests, there were 8mm reel to reel, there were stone tablets that birds would chisel out. I mean, this
they're putting out an app next year, I think.
Yeah, this encompassed everything. But the dollar issues of DC Special, DC Special Series number one, when I say it, everyone listening will go, and that is Five Star Superhero Spectacular with that beautiful Neil Adams cover. The next one is DC Special Series number 5, which they talk about, Superman Spectacular. And that is the second coming of Superman, the famous cover of Superman laying dead and Brainiac and Luthor with their hands. And I am legally, morally, and soulfully obligated to say that this was reprinted in the Best of DC number 59 Digest. There is the Wonder Woman Spectacular.
Also
a
very
great
good
issue. Yeah, the great issue. Wonder Woman with her fist up in the air. Super, super mad. The Flash Spectacular.
Also awesome.
Yep, that's that cool with the three Flashes running through like a time warp and Gorilla Grodd is hanging over them. There was Sergeant Rock Spectacular, and that was DC Special Series number 13. The DC Special Series number 15, which as soon as I'm done recording, I have to go on eBay and get it before all my Bat cousins get it from out from under me, because I still don't have it. And this is the Batman Spectacular.
Really? You don't have that? Oh, man.
The cover is Batman with a hangman's noose.
Yeah, that's a great... You know, I thought we should do a special recording on that one at some point, because that's almost a Batman Family comic.
Yep.
And there are three stories. Hang the Batman, I Now Pronounce You Batman and Wife, and Death Strikes at Midnight in 3. DC Special Series number 16 is Jonah Hex Spectacular. DC Special Series number 17 and number 20 are Swamp Things. Number 22 is GI Combat. And quite possibly I have saved the best for last, and that is DC Special Series number 21, and that is Superstar Holiday Spectacular. Add that. And that, of course, has Jonah Hex, The Fawn and the Star, Batman, Wanted Santa Claus Dead or Alive, Sergeant Rock, The Loneliest Night. And I am morally, legally, and soulfully obligated to say that the Legion of Superheroes story, Starlight, Star Bright, Farther Star I See Tonight, was reprinted in Best of DC Digest. I don't have the number, and I'm horrible with comic numbers. I think it's 22. It's Christmas with the Superheroes. I may have said it before, I don't know, but that is my all-time favorite comic book story ever. Absolutely love it.
Really? I didn't know that, Sean.
And
that, wasn't that the issue that we found out that Colossal Boy was Jewish?
Yes.
Pretty sure exactly. That was
yes.
It.
Because they show Christmas celebrations and other celebrations and no celebrations around the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Written by Paul Evans.
And that is the rise and fall of the DC Dollar Comics. Bat Cousins, if you have treasured memories of Dollar Comics, please, please, please write in, because I love Dollar Comics. So I'm manifesting this. I hope that there is a podcast just about Dollar Comics out there. So someone start that so I can listen to it. Because I already have 10,000 podcasts that I listen to.
Sean, well done on your first Bat history.
So thank you, Bat Cousins. We will return next month with Batman Family number 18. And we hope to see you then. Have a great day. Bye.
You're not done yet.
Oh, I have to do more talking? Okay.
Like, that's a problem for you.
We are going to talk about the cover of Batman Family number 17. April, May, 1978. The release date was January 19th, 1978. It is 80 pages. It is our first dollar comic. Yay. There are three all-new stories. And the cover artist is Mike Kaluta. Let me see what you guys think about the cover. I'm sure you have a lot to say. We're going to start off with Martin.
So as you mentioned, it is a Mike Kaluta cover. And what I love about that is it's this great layout of five stars with the Batman family. You've got Batman in the center. You've got Robin and Huntress on one side and Batgirl and Man-Bat on the other. And you'd mentioned just in your recap, what this instantly reminded me of was that dollar comic one shot of Five Star Spectacular. But here, yeah, we actually get the five-star layout, which I thought was really cool. Just in general, for me, Kaluta's artwork, I think of horror-type comics. So this one had that tone. And what I really liked interesting about it is, looking at that cover, the pointy elements with the cowls. You got Batman's points, you got Batgirl's points, you got Huntress's mask points, and you got Man-Bat's ears. I feel left out for poor Robin. He doesn't have anything.
That's a good point, Martin. I mean, Sean, this is iconic cover. I think this might be my favorite Batman Family cover. I can't say enough good things about it. Each of them are looking, you know, Robin's looking down and Batgirl's looking up sort of pensively. Batman's sort of holding his, I think it's his cape with a cityscape behind. And Man-Bat looks fabulous.
Yeah, Man-Bat looks great. I'm actually going to say something that's not 100% positive. And before I do this, first of all, I love this cover. Kaluta is fantastic. Fantastic as an artist, absolutely beautiful, fantastic. And it's not going to be like the quote unquote boxed cover because of the stars.
I was going to ask you if it was the box, because somewhat boxed.
Nope, that's great. And I absolutely love, and I don't know that this was Kaluta necessarily, but like the stalk the night shrouded streets with the Batman family. If you absolutely love that. And also like the cityscape in the background, I absolutely love that. That's like Rogers-esque. I love it. Super. When I say this, this is not like a cover killer for me or anything. I just wish it were slightly different. Batman looks great. Robin looks great. Batgirl looks great. Huntress looks great. Man-Bat looks great. They all look fantastic. The stars are fantastic. Everything is great. The only thing I don't like is Batman, Robin, Batgirl are all kind of like in action poses, or they're involved in something versus Huntress and Man-Bat, who are just kind of looks like they're on the Love Boat, like just like looking into the camera, like almost like a poster. I wish all five were either like in action doing something, or I don't want all five looking at the camera like that, but I just wish it was all the same. And when I say that, Bat Cousins, I'm not complaining about this cover. This cover is beautiful. You know, I absolutely love this cover. I just wish it would have been quote unquote the same kind of pose for them.
That's a fair comment. I think it's cool. I mean, Huntress is a brand new character. This is her fourth appearance in this book. I mean, how much more family can you get, right? So it makes sense. We will post the image of this cover, of course, as well as some additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Sean, I keep forgetting. What is that website?
Well, I don't have to forget because I've committed it to memory, but I will read it off my page right here. And that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Now, let's jump into that first story.
All right, our first story is called Scars, starring Batman and Robin, the dynamic duo, with a guest appearance of the Huntress. It is a 23-pager by Jerry Conway, his first appearance in Batman Family, and Jim Aparo Interiors, his first interiors in Batman Family, which is pretty neat. We're getting a traditional Batman and Robin story, but it's clearly in the continuity of the Robin stories that we've been getting, as you'll be able to tell. It has been reprinted a few times in the Tales of the Batman, Jerry Conway, Volume 1, Legends of the Dark Knight, Jim Aparo, Volume 3, and our favorite Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus from 2020. Batman and Robin in Scars. Batman is on patrol on a great silent Aparo splash page. He notices a newspaper article detailing the disappearance of famous actress Margot Mulhare. Soon after that, as he makes his way towards Margot's last known location, he notices a young woman in the distance. He thinks, hey, that's got to be Margot due to, quote, that hair, that swaying walk, and those legs. Sounds like Playboy Brucey might have known this Margot pretty well. But anyway, the woman turns around and her face is horribly deformed, almost as if she has no face. She attacks Batman with an unnatural strength, and Batman struggles to get free. But a masked man appears and calls to Millie to stop. She immediately calms down and gets in his car. The man tells Batman his name is Drake and that he prefers to conceal his deformity. He mentions that Millie has wandered off and that they are from an amusement park, quote, over in New Jersey. The weird duo drive off, much to the Dark Knight detective's confusion. He returns to the Groovy Wayne Foundation penthouse to find his trusty ward Dick waiting for him with a big frown on his face. Woman trouble. Seems that Lori's ex, Studley football star Desmond Mallard, is back in the picture. He left school abruptly after an injury last year and dropped all his friends, including Lori, like a hot potato. I guess Dick was her rebound boyfriend. But he called Lori out of the blue yesterday and begged her to come to Gotham to see him. Even though she was over him, Lori couldn't refuse his plea for help, so back to Gotham they came. But the dynamic duo's man-to-man talk is interrupted by an intruder alert. They suit up and find a young costumed woman in purple and blue in the building. Robin tries to take her out of action, but she sends him to the ground with a very painful-looking backflip. She introduces herself, in a way, you might say, I'm your daughter. Of course, it is Helena Wayne from Earth 2, the Huntress. As Alfred serves tea, she tells them the reason she's come to Earth 1, to get advice from Batman, since she can't tell her own dad that she's fighting crime. I guess the geezers in the JSA were no help either. But 1970s, little bit sexist Bruce declines, saying she would be better helped by an older, experienced superheroine like Batwoman. Kathy just happens to be visiting a nearby amusement park in New Jersey, named the Island of a Thousand Thrills. No, not really. We wish, though. Anyway, Batman takes Helena to the amusement park to introduce her to Kathy, and he figures he will check up on this Mr. Drake at the same time. Meanwhile, Dick goes to pick up Lori at the hotel and finds out she is checked out. She left Dick a note saying that Desmond asked her to meet him at an amusement park in New Jersey. Coincidence? I think not. And neither does the world's second greatest detective. Kathy and Helena hit it off and decide to go see Batgirl so Bat Cousin Bob can write the next story. Helena gives her new Uncle Bruce a goodbye kiss, and he wonders what it would be like to have a daughter. But his musings are cut short as Batman uses his keen detective skills to see a giant banner advertising the girl with no face. He investigates the sensitively named Freak Show, and what he finds turns his stomach, a Dr. Moreau-like set of cages with human-animal hybrids. And because he was so surprised, the 1970s not infallible Batman is conked on the head from behind and knocked out. When he comes to, he is in a great Bronze Age death trap, hanging upside down with his utility belt emptied out. Below him is Lori Elton, locked up on a table about to be operated on by the madman Drake. The world's greatest detective quickly realizes that this is Lori's ex, Desmond Mallard. Get it? Mallard? Drake? Mallard monologues about how beautiful he was. Not like other men. I was special. The football injury was more than a sprain. It scarred his face for life. He exhausted his money on doctors to no avail. So he returned to Hudson U and he found out the woman he had loved had moved on. So of course, he decided to undertake a sacred quest and make beautiful people ugly. Now he's ready to do the same to Lori. Batman keeps Mallard talking long enough for Dick to arrive at the park. Despite his van breaking down? Really? Batman, of course, escapes the trap and saves Lori in a beautifully rendered sequence by Aparo. Robin slows down Mallard enough for Batman to catch up, then changes back into Dick to go in and comfort Lori. Batman catches Mallard, pulls the Scooby-Doo mask off of him, and we discover that his terribly disfigured reason he turned all these people's lives into wrecks was a tiny scar beneath his eye. As Jerry Conway puts it, Batman knows that the deepest scars are in the soul. The end. Martin, Sean, what do you guys think of scars? Martin, let's start with you.
I am a huge Jim Aparo fan. If I was going to rank my favorite artists who did Batman in the 70s during the Bronze Age, Aparo would probably be number one because of his work on Brave and Bold. Irv Novak, who did the regular artwork in Batman at the time, would be number two. Then I would go with Dick Dillon because of his artwork on Justice League and World's Finest. So Aparo's right up there. For me, because I love Brave and Bold so much, this issue reminded me almost like a lost Brave and Bold issue. You got Aparo's artwork, you got Batman, his team up is with Robin, which is cool. So I thought that was really cool. And this is the first appearance of Huntress meeting her other family members,
absolutely,
which was amazing for me. And I loved her debut, so I was all in on that one. So
how about you, Sean? General thoughts?
Yeah, I really loved it. So we'll start off. So I'm middle of the road, Aparo. I think there's a bunch of stuff in here that's absolutely fantastic, absolutely beautiful, great. I don't know that I'm going to do them in order. Everything with Huntress looks fantastic. When Robin puts his cape up and the acid is eating through it, I think he looks great there. When Robin jumps down over the fence, going into a crouch, like that artwork is great. Batman swinging and doing like the thing with the filament with the light bulb. Like Aparo's artwork is just fantastic in this issue.
That escape sequence that you're talking about, for those of you following home, that's pages 18 through 20, where Batman escapes the trap. That is really pretty classic.
I guess I'll bring it up now. We could have talked about this during any of the issue. I really like this because it's three basically 20-page stories. And I almost wish Batman Family would have stayed with that. Even if they would have had to rotate one feature out, I would have been fine with that, just because I do like these longer stories, which you can get more character development, like a supporting cast, all of that kind of thing. So I like the length of this issue. In terms of like what I quote unquote don't like about the story, you know, I'm sure I've read this probably hundreds of times, but man, this time, this story, the people in the freak show, it's like that worm man and that chicken lady. And it's, I guess because like horror now is stuff like horrible stuff, like the human centipede and stuff like that. It did bother me more this time than ever.
You know, I'm going to talk about that because, you know, normally you think of that stuff as fake. So here we find out this guy who was a football player all of a sudden is able to graft animal parts on the Bronze Age, you know, go Jerry. But it's really nasty when you think about it.
Yeah. I think even at this point, maybe it was a bit of a cliche that someone who thinks of themselves as deformed has just like a little small scar. It probably at this time is cliche. But for me, it wasn't. It probably was the first time that idea was presented to me. So I'm like, oh my gosh, he's not horrible. He just thinks that. That really goes a long way with the story.
Let's walk through. I mentioned it in the synopsis, the silent page to start. I always like the silent pages, and I think Aparo is good at conveying what's happening. The panel where the paper bumps up against Batman's leg and he happens to pick it up and sees Actress is missing.
I can hear that. I can hear like the wind and the...
I thought it was funny how he was confused when they drove off. He's like, what? Huh? I really like how in the penthouse, we get to see Batman without the cowl. So you see Bruce in his outfit with his cowl pulled back. And then he's reclining on the recliner as Dick's telling the story. I love that on page 5. That's super cool.
So I've read the Huntress stories in, and you said this was the fourth
to JSA, and she had of course the DC special where she was introduced, you know, with her origin and everything.
In those stories, did it say, I'm hopping over to Earth One to
talk
or this is just the
part of me is like, well, you know, she had enough training that she was able to break into the penthouse, right? But she's looking for help, which is fine. I mean, she could have just wanted to meet those guys. I thought that was really neat. I think it's interesting to see Dick's emotions about her, because he's like, yeah. Where would this have left me?
Yeah.
He's met the Earth 2 Robin. He could have asked him.
So being generous and no prizing it. Dick Grayson is Dick Grayson, so that's the same. And even on Earth 2, Dick Grayson wasn't Bruce Wayne's offspring. Mm-hmm. Versus Helena, where that is that familial bond or connection. The fact that he's not, quote unquote, related to Bruce. So maybe that is what really kicks off that feeling, that thought process.
Well, I do like how it's been pretty headstrong the last few issues. Even when Don Heck was drawing him looking like a 12-year-old, he was rushing into things. And so I like how he, you know, rushes in without talking. I just like that sequence. It's charming, right? They get to meet each other.
And I think because we only had 22 pages, I mean, looking back at this now, when I was a kid, didn't question it at all. But now I was thinking about this and I said, well, there's a missing piece. You're right about the when did she decide to go? She clearly had to talk to somebody from the JSA and say, hey, I want to go to Earth One. Okay, we'll use the transmatter cube. All of a sudden, if this woman just shows up on the transmatter cube in the satellite, is there going to be an issue? So who went over with her? So my headcanon is, well, Wildcat accompanied her to the JLA satellite.
Yeah.
Let's say Green Arrow and Black Canary. Green Arrow was on Monitor Duty. Black Canary was hanging out.
So Wildcat was having some beers.
Basically,
with
Wildcat goes, this is the Huntress. This is, you know, a new team member. She wants to go talk to Batman. They're like, okay, cool. Should we call ahead? And then Ollie gets distracted because Dinah and Ted are having conversations about that one time they were together. And no, Ollie's not jealous. He's like, okay, whatever. Beams her down, says, no problem. Get to Gotham City. Forgets to call Bruce because logically this woman just shows up and nowhere does she indicate. She kind of says later, yeah, like I said, upstairs, and I introduced myself. Robin's headstrong and jumps. Batman's like, huh, strange woman, purple costume in my building. Okay, I'm gonna let Robin get trounced and then we'll talk to her. So, you know, but when I was 12, I was okay with this. Totally. I'm like, she's here. This is great.
If this were written by Bob Haney, he would have used his bat sense to know that she was related to him.
Okay.
I found it interesting. Why did Batman stay as Batman, but Huntress changed into Helena to go meet Kathy?
And where are those clothes? Because she didn't have a suitcase.
Listen, Bruce has plenty of women's clothes.
Here's the missing piece of the story. She beamed over, she brought her suitcase, and she left it outside. How long was she coming for? She's going to just come over and go, well, I got this extra outfit. Where am I keeping it?
It's folded up and squished down inside her cape.
That's me being a nitpicking adult. As a kid, again, didn't care.
I do think there's not a shortage of women's outfits in the penthouse.
Okay.
Anyway, so then we're at the amusement park and he introduces her and they take off because they're going to the next store. He goes to check out the freak show and we get to the part where he questions the guy and found some inconsistencies in Drake's story that he's said he'd been there a while, but he really hasn't. I always think, doesn't the carnival check up on their employees? Guess not.
Probably not, especially back then.
Back then they're like, oh, you got freaky people? Great. Let's make a giant poster. Yeah. He gets whacked. And then we get this great scene in the lair. He tells this story about all how he wasted all his money. And then he starts experimenting on people. There's a guy in the background at the top of 17 with the body of a snake and the head of a human.
Creepy
stuff. There's that panel at the bottom where Robin's jumping down that you like, Sean. That's really cool. Really well done. Jim Aparo was really good with capes.
Speaking of 17, did you notice the graffiti on the wall in that panel just before? You got Kathy plus Bob. So clearly Bob was that the preliminary to. And Milgram was here.
I
hadn't noticed that until now.
Good catch.
Nice catch,
Martin.
One thing I think is funny is, so when you see Batman hanging upside down, you see his utility belt is loosened, but he still has it on. I don't get that.
That's weird. Usually the villains just take it off.
Yeah.
But these guys, they emptied all the stuff out. That was a strange approach. I agree with that, Sean. It makes for an interesting visual. We don't usually get to see it loose and opened like that. Yeah. Right? I mean, we've seen it plenty of times where the villain takes it away. Then there's the panel of Robin using his cape to stop the acid.
I love that panel.
And then goes back and takes care of Lori. She's got to know by now that she's hanging out with a superhero and pulls the ugly mask off. It's always good to see those rubber masks. You know, you mentioned this, somebody not really that disfigured. John Byrne did it later with Dr. Doom, right?
Yeah.
I was going to ask that. Is Dr. Doom all messed up or is it just a little?
I think he really is.
And I think that works better for Dr. Doom.
Yeah, but John Byrne did it. He made him like this with only a small scar.
Yeah.
If I remember
he had a small scar. And then because he was so full of himself, when he went to the monks and they took the scalding hot mask and stuck it on his face, well, that little scar is nothing compared to what was going to happen when that scalding hot mask was put on his face.
Right, right.
But yeah, I was thinking Dr. Doom when I saw this too. And I'm like, is Jerry kind of like going, huh, this is our way to maybe make a DC version of Dr. Doom or something?
I don't know. This guy was loose of a few screws, I think.
And in terms of men in masks, Darth Vader is handsome under there, right?
Okay.
I might have to catch up on a few movies.
That was great. So anything else that we forgot?
Yeah. So we're not completely done because you talked about how this guy's name is Drake. And
Mallard.
I can't imagine that this had anything to do with it, but like Darkwing Duck's real name is Drake Mallard.
Oh, good catch.
Good catch. That's right. But he's still years from being created, right?
Yeah, I don't think the creators of Darkwing Duck read this issue. Might have. I'm gonna name my superhero after the guy who deforms people. Now we move on to the Bat timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month and what the rest of the Batman family was doing at that time. And this is all thanks to the newsstand feature of Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. And this issue was on sale January 1978. And the Bat books this month is all new collector's edition C56, Superman versus Muhammad Ali. And technically, only the back of Batman's head is on the cover, but this is obviously a book of the month. Paul, I know you have this book. What about you, Martin?
Oh, I still have my copy somewhere around. Yep.
Yeah, it's one of the most famous comic books of all time, so I have to call it out.
Oh, yeah.
And then a surprise, Batman actually guest stars in Aquaman number 61 as they battle the deadliest man alive, Cobra. And there... Oof, that is an awesome apparel cover with Aquaman and a scuba diving Batman getting captured in a net.
And our next one is Batman number 298, The Case of the Crimson Coffin. This is another Aparo cover, but past Bat Family history subject John Hounen provides the art on the inside. And the cover is really great because like Batman's in the middle and there's one guy with his sword raised and he's going to chop him. And then you see a reflection of Batman in the knife that's facing you. So there's another mirror on the Batcave wall behind them giving that reflection on that knife that's facing you because I know my physics.
I was going to say on this one, it's a very cool effect, but it doesn't really work.
There are no Brave and the Bold or Detective Comics this month.
But in Justice League number 153, the JLA takes on Ultra, not the multi-alien. Sorry, Rob. I guess Jerry Conway decided that name must have been too good not to use. This was after Englehart had left the book, and it's written by Jerry Conway. And it's his third issue in the run. Unfortunately, it's a little bit of a tomahawk because we have this fabulous Rich Buckler cover. And George Tuska on the inside. And then there's Super Friends number 11. This epic showdown has the Super Friends going up against the Kingslayer. Now, this is a special book for me because I covered this story on For All Mankind with Rob Kelly on my very first podcast ever. And now look at me. What have you done, Rob?
Yeah, so Bat Cousins, you probably know I'm a huge fan of the Super Friends comic book. It's probably my second favorite comic book run ever behind Batman Family. I listen to For All Mankind every month. It's one of the few podcasts that I always make a comment on each month because I love it so much. Soon-ish coming to an end. So if you like Super Friends, definitely check it out. It's a great podcast. The next one is a super anniversary issue, Dollar Comics. It's World's Finest number 250. And it stars Superman, Batman, Green Arrow, Black Canary, and Wonder Woman in The Reality War. And then there's another story with Creeper in Return of the Past. And I love when anthology books have all of their stars together in a story. I absolutely love that. Martin, what do you have on your pull list for this month?
So I did a quick count of this, and looking at that entire list, I believe I had picked up, or between subscriptions and newsstand, I had about 30 things on this list. Now, I realize where this money came from. This was January, so I had Christmas money. That's what I think. And Justice League, as I mentioned, was one of the books I had a subscription for, which is really cool. Like, real quick comment about that story. So the story idea behind that was the five heroes that were featured in it were the top poll getters in a poll at the time: Batman, Superman, Flash, Green Lantern, and Green Arrow. Wonder Woman and whoever else was six and seven appeared, but that was it. And this was the one where they went to Earth Prime.
Oh, that's right.
And it posed the question of, does the appearance of a hero bring evil, or does evil propagate the need for a hero? And I think the story ended up coming out saying, okay, Ultra, the reason that Earth Prime's having all these problems is because of you. So you need to leave. And they dragged him to Earth One, and we see him again in JLA probably about another 10 or 15 issues down the road.
Well, but in regards to that question
that
was posed, Bonnie Tyler said we're holding out for a hero. So I definitely side with her.
Okay, fair enough.
Paul, that's a pop culture reference of a song from the 80s. Yes,
the soundtrack. Yes. I know my music.
I remember the song. I didn't remember the artist's name, so I was halfway there on that one, Sean.
Sing it if you really wanted to. Which you okay, moving on. So a couple things I want to mention out of that things. That Amazing Spider-Man issue, 179. That was the first issue of a Spider-Man subscription I started. Ooh. And I got that because I remember it was a middle school fundraiser, and my grandmother bought magazines and she bought me a comic book subscription. So that's how I got that one.
All right.
Secret Society, I mentioned before, I had the sub and it would be good for another month. Gotta love DC Special Series number 10 with
there
more
you go.
Cool Secret Origins. Yeah. Ties in with this whole Huntress thing because that's where we got her from, a Secret Origins issue of DC Superstars. Showcase 99, the third part of Power Girls, three-parter.
Yep.
Star Wars 10 was the last part of the four-part storyline that was the first storyline after original Star Wars. I won't call it A New Hope because back then it was just Star Wars. Now I'm going to channel my inner Harvey Dent for a moment. There were two spectacular second issues on this list that I had: Firestorm number 2 and Laugh Olympics number 2.
All right.
So flip that coin. Finally, gotta mention the great Superman book, which I still have my copy of, guys.
Awesome.
$8.95 is what it cost at the bookstore when I bought it.
Yeah.
Back
well,
in
you know,
the day.
That's, I was going to ask that because I noted that. And it says here, we only get a hardcover reference.
Paperback was $8.95. So the one book I would have bought that I didn't have and I never saw, but I would have bought this if I had seen it. And it is Richie Rich and Casper number 23. And I'll tell you why I love this guy. I love that title. I think I had the first, probably issue 2 or 3 was the first one I got of that series back in the day. But for me, this is almost like Harvey Comics version of The World's Finest, because you got Richie Rich and you got Casper. They're one and number two.
Yeah.
Boom. It was always a good read. And I loved it back before I got into my superhero books. So if I hadn't seen this one, I would have bought this one.
Yeah.
Well, we might as well talk about Richie Rich now, Sean. He's back on the right track. Looks like last month, he's back up to 11 here. I love the fact that he's not only got Super Richie, but he has something now that I haven't noticed before: Richie Rich's Vaults of Mystery. It just amazes me, the different genres. I guess he's like Batman. He works in every genre.
It's probably how Archie was Archie, but then weirdly enough, little Archie was a little bit more adventure driven. I guess it's probably the same thing with like Vault of Mystery. I guess he, Okay, so I'll rattle off a couple of my books, and I'll try to stay away from the stuff that Martin already talked about. Action Comics number 482. I have to get that because of the Supermobile. Absolutely love it. And of course, I have to get Challengers of the Unknown number 86 because of Deadman.
Deadman's in there, yeah.
I picked Flintstones number 4, and it's kind of exactly like what Martin was saying. This is the Flintstones meeting at least George Jetson.
Yes.
The number 1 and 2 of Hanna-Barbera.
Sean, I had that one on my list for that very reason. I'm like, what? The Flintstones met George Jetson? I do not have this story. I want to read this now.
And actually, I didn't pick up on this until Paul just said it. So technically, I did have the great Superman book on my list because I did have it, but I didn't have it until it came out in paperback. So technically, I probably wouldn't have gotten it then. It probably came out like a year a year later. I also had Laugh Olympics. Speaking of Laugh, I had Laugh Comics Digest number 15, which of course is an Archie title. And then the next ones kind of sort of had, but not really. So Power Records are listed. Power Records 33, 34, and 35. And it's Superman and the Man from Krypton, Superman and City Under Siege, and Wonder Woman Secret of the Magic Tiara. But the artwork for these, look it up, cousins. I don't want to say it doesn't look good because it's Neil Adams, so it looks good. But it's just odd because it's kind of just the characters against like a colored background.
A Coletta-like background.
Yeah, really, yeah. And there's like a really weird like book and record set logo on the top.
I was going to ask you about that, Sean, because I thought you would pull them. And they're cropped very strangely, it seems to me. And I agree. I think they're unattractive.
Yeah, I love Power Records, but like, I just don't think that they, I don't think like the design of these look good. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure Chris or Rob will take us to task for saying that. So guys, have at it.
Well, let me say they don't look as good as the versions that I am used to seeing them.
Fair enough.
Like, I also listed Secret Society of Supervillains, Spider-Woman number one.
There you go. Yeah, you caught that one. That's right.
Bat Cousins, I'm really looking for a color collection of Spider-Woman. So if you guys know of that, let me know. I actually have the Marvel Essential, and I'm not a huge fan of the black and white.
I think the only ones are the Essentials, which I have them as well. And I had the comics, and they're long gone. I've sold them years ago. They do have Marvel Masterworks, which are, of course, pricey. But you might be able to rent that on Hoopla, Sean.
Yeah, which is a good use of the library, yes.
Yeah, but I don't think there's a paperback color version of those stories. Yeah.
They're definitely on the Marvel app, though. So I've read, I reread them recently there.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
The second to last book I'm going to talk about is Superman number 322, and that's because it features a parasite. And why in the world the parasite is not a live action Superman villain, I don't know. He looks fantastic. The power set would be so translatable to live action. I'm tired of seeing Lex Luthor for the 834th time.
Yep.
Bring Parasite in. The last book I'm going to talk about is Walt Disney Showcase number 43, and it's Pete's Dragon. I do like the movie of Pete's Dragon. I kind of think this Gold Key comic probably has absolutely horrible art.
Yeah.
Literally, the only reason I'm talking about this is to bring up the song Brazzle Dazzle Day from Pete's Dragon. Easily within my top 10 Disney songs of all time, probably top five. Nobody knows it. You probably don't know it. Maybe we'll link to a YouTube video of the song, but I love the rhyming structure of that song, and I just wanted to talk about it. And when am I ever going to talk about Brazzle Dazzle Day on Batman Family Reunion?
There you go.
I think the only song from Pete's Dragon I know is that Helen Reddy one, which
Candle
is really
on the Water,
good.
Yeah.
Yep, which is a good song.
How about you? What are you pulling off the news?
All right, so other than what we've talked about, a couple of Marvels and Avengers, number 170, you've got Perez cover and art with Jocasta. Always like when Jocasta showed up.
Okay, yeah.
And Captain America number 220, where Cap is fighting a giant Cap Ameridroid. So sign me up for that. That's always fun. Now, you mentioned Firestorm number 2, Martin. I just wanted to mention the fact that Firestorm came out last month, number 1. Here we've got Superman guest starring, and also by Jerry Conway, who's really ramping it up now that he's at DC full time. I want to call out John Carter, Warlord of Mars, number 11. So that one has a Deja Thoris cover by Dave Cockrum. I don't know. Did you guys ever read any John Carter? No. A few years ago, I read the original actual short, stories, novellas, and they were pretty good, pretty dated culturally, but pretty amazing world building for that time period for stories that are 100 years old. That's a striking cover, obviously, with the gorgeous Dave Cockrum. Neither of you mentioned Machine Man number 1. So now that's not his first appearance. He came out of 2001, A Space Odyssey by Jack Kirby. And this is a weird series. A few years ago, they had a paperback and half of it is Jack Kirby and then lay dormant for a little while. And then the other half is Steve Ditko. Weird stuff. Marvel Team Up 68, more Claremont and Byrne. I've got to call that out every month. Guest star this time, The Man Thing, probably one of the first times I would have seen him. And I had no idea that here we are, 1978, Gold Key put out a Star Trek comic, number 51. It does go to 61 issues, goes all the way up till Marvel took over the license in 1980, and they actually published into late 1979 or maybe even early 90. I might have had one or two, but I wasn't really into Star Trek probably till, another year or two later. But we haven't seen a Star Trek comic on these episodes that I can recall, Sean, so I wanted to call that out. And then last two, Steel, the Indestructible Man, number 2, another number 2, Martin, that another Jerry Conway, Don Heck, though, I have fond memories of this series. I don't really remember the storyline until, you know, he was brought back with his grandson, of course, in the Justice League. But for some reason, I always thought this occurred on Earth 2, but maybe it was on Earth 1. So I don't really remember. Is that retconned or what? I can't remember.
I think it's retconned because originally it was just, if I had issue 1, I don't remember getting issue 2. And it was just set during World War II. Mm-hmm. Now, the assumption could be, well, World War II usually was Earth 2, but yeah. It didn't necessarily. Yeah. I don't think they did it until they introduced Steel in Justice League Detroit.
Yeah. Well, and I think, so I'm not exactly sure. So if I'm wrong, you can edit this out. I think on Earth Prime, we had World War II.
Yeah, we did.
Okay, we did. Okay. Keep that in, Paul.
Speaking of World War II, last one I'll bring up. I very rarely bought war comics, but just look at The Unknown Soldier, number 214, with a fabulous Joe Kubert cover with guest starring Mademoiselle Marie. If there was a character who I did think was cool, it was The Unknown Soldier, and always like it when they had these crossovers. And she's saying, I'd rather die than be rescued by you. So, I mean, that's another one I got to track down and see if I can find a read. All right, are we ready to move on?
Yes, we are going to move on to the second story of the issue, and that is Horoscopes of Crime with Batgirl and Huntress and Batwoman. There are 21 pages written by our personal friend, Bob Rozakis, penciled by Don Heck, inked by Bob Wycheck and Vince Coletta. Later reprinted in Batgirl, The Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2, hardcover from 2019. So the story has some chapters, so we're going to split it up a bit. We're going to alternate our synopsis and then talk about the story at the end. Batgirl, The Huntress, Batwoman, Poison Ivy, Catwoman, Madame Zodiac, Carol Channing, Margot Channing, and Charo in The Horoscopes of Crime. Madame Zodiac and her huge, huge, huge tarot-ish cards, seriously, these things are as big as her face, tell the future losses of Poison Ivy and Catwoman to Batgirl and Huntress. And a plot point I completely don't understand, Madame Zodiac tells the women that if they fail at their crimes, they will pay her twice her fee?
And they say yes.
Okay. We then roll right into chapter one. So I wish these would have had subtitles like chapter one, Treaty of Pain. With the help of an old high school friend, Barbara is hosting three world leaders, a UN ambassador, and her boss, Senator Thomas Cleary, in a ranger's tower in New York State. A tree branch comes in and tentacles its way around Babs and yanks her out. Although the group tries to save her, they can't, but Batgirl can. She soon realizes that Smokey Bear and Woodsy Owl have not turned rogue. Nope, it's Poison Ivy who is causing all of this brouhaha with an energizer gun. Batgirl stomps out crime by stomping her boot down on the gun. Then, an unseen figure whomps Batgirl on the head. Now, normally, I don't like it when the stars of the book are assaulted so roughly, but on the upside, it means that I'm done with this recap.
In chapter two, I wish this had a title, but it doesn't. But as promised in the first story, Kathy sends Helena aboard a flight to Provincetown. But as she is boarding the flight, Catwoman strike. Selina is there to kidnap, or is that catnap, Catfish Turner, a famous baseball player. Helena changes to Huntress, and despite Catwoman looking like a young version of her mother, she engages the feline femme fatale and her goons in battle. She uses her crossbow dart gun to take out the goons, but Catwoman grabs Catfish in her Cat 09 tails and keeps the Huntress at bay. But Catfish does a Linda Carter spin, untangling himself and knocking Catwoman down. Helena goes in to apprehend her, but starts to freeze up, again remembering her late mother. But she recovers in time to knock her out. But for her own trouble, she too is now the third character in this issue to be knocked out from behind. In the interlude, we find out that it was indeed Madame Zodiac who saved both Catwoman and Poison Ivy. The two supervillainesses agree to pay double her fee, and the terrible trio plots their next move.
Chapter 3, which I'm calling the Zodiac Zone. Our three heroines have a great scene where they are discussing aspects of superheroing and decide to go to lunch close to the Provincetown Museum. Madame Zodiac, meanwhile, is telling Pam and Selina all about the caper that she has planned. They are going to steal an item that will appeal to both of their perfectly understandable gimmicks, not like symbols or anything. Some great bat action follows as all three stars get to make short work of the villains. But Madame Zodiac must have been the 14th member of the Legion of Doom in the early episodes of Challenge of the Super Friends, because even though she is captured at the story's end, she fades away to Tarot Card Another Day. Martin, you were spared from having to do a synopsis
of this story.
Tell us what you thought of the story.
Okay.
That says it all.
I know. I remember this one, and it was, you know, back in the day, I enjoyed it because this was jam-packed with three heroines, three villains, including a debut of Madame Zodiac, first-time new villain. I'm like, this is great. Perfect combination for me, except the artwork, because I felt that the inks had such a heavy weight to them.
Yeah.
And it just muddied it for me. And going back to this, I'm like, oh, I kind of lost some of this stuff. Now, I do have a couple nitpicks, but I think I'll wait until we walk through on a couple things. But there's a couple things I found, again, as a kid, I wouldn't have noticed. But as an adult, I'm like, okay. But I will give one plus point for the colorists. If you look at Huntress's outfit in the story one, and then you go to what she's wearing here, the colors match. So there was definitely some notes handing off and keeping this consistent. So I thought that that was a definite plus. So
I'm actually going to start off with positive stuff. So first of all, and I think we kind of said it before, I absolutely love that the Huntress storyline kind of runs through all three stories. Yes. I think that is fantastic. I am about to praise Don Heck. So Bat Cousins, be prepared.
Wait, is Kid Flash in this story?
Starting on page 16, close to the bottom, they have the characters talking, and Don Heck actually puts a little headshot of them by their caption box. And I have never seen any other artist ever do that. And I absolutely love that. I think that's spectacular. I think it's great. It's probably the only time I've ever used those two words in combination with Don Heck art. So a couple of things. I do think the idea of the story is great. It's all these female superheroines and super villainesses. I love that. I love the characterization where Helena is going to Barbara and Kathy to get tips, tricks, just to talk about their common experiences. Love that. So that all of that is fantastic. I think Madame Zodiac is probably interesting. It probably is a gimmick that sticks, that is visual, that you understand. Mm-hmm. What you were saying, Martin, about the inking being heavy, and I guess I'll say it now, in my issue, and I'm not sure if everybody's issue is like this, I kind of think each story suffers from almost like a misprinting. It's almost like out of sync a little bit.
That happens. I've seen that happen before. Mine's not like, I don't think I have that issue.
Like a not even a millimeter. So whatever is shorter than a millimeter.
There was a little bit. If I remember my original copy, I mean, again, I reviewed these on the digital, but I remember my original copy, and that wasn't uncommon back then to get a little bit off on the colors.
Yeah. Like if it was at the end or the beginning of the print run or something, I think I read something about this before. I don't have that problem with my issue, Sean. Mine is as clear as the other issues. I guess the quality of the printing is what you're talking about.
And in the other two stories, I can see some examples of this. But I think because like what Martin was saying, how it's so weighty and dark with the ink, I think in this story, unfortunately, it just brings it out even more because of that.
Well, you guys covered most of my general points. The one thing that I thought was funny in this is I think Bob Rozek is channeling Batman 66. Both Catwoman and Poison Ivy are very punny in this story. Little over the top, if you ask me. I probably rolled my eyes when I was 12 reading this. Let's start walking through. So in part one, when I read it, because I'm not reading ahead, so I read it in preparation. I was like, wait, is Madame Xanadu in this comic book?
Yeah, no.
So I thought that was funny. I thought it was a good use of Babs's friends, Senator Tom Cleary, who I kept thinking they want to make a love interest, but I don't think they ever really do.
This is why I think like a 20-page story is great, because then you do have time
to do
for that like interaction. You can even have a whole page where maybe like they're out on a date or at work or whatever, versus an 8 or 10-page story where you need that to set up the plot. You need the action. You need the denouement. You don't have time for that. In this story, you do.
So I have a fashion question for you guys. And Lizanne, if you're listening, this is for you as well. So on pages 5 and 6, Babs gets captured by the vine. And then at the bottom of page 6, we see her changing out of her outfit. She's wearing a skirt when she's grabbed by the vine. And then she shows up. Like, how does she change boots? Did she have her leggings on? Like, that was so jarring to me because it was on the opposite sides of the page. You see her skirt where she doesn't have any leggings on. It's her bare legs. And then you see her like in the bottom half of her Batgirl outfits. If our Bat fashionista Lizanne has any comments on how that's accomplished when one is being entangled by a vine, love to hear it.
Yes, I was questioning that too. I said, at least the boots were the right length The color was slightly different. And I'm like, oh, she's got magic changing boot colors. And oh, by the way, magically changing her clothes. I didn't know that was one of Babs's powers.
Yeah.
But again, forgiving it. I was 12. I didn't care.
And I'm going to reach out to the Poison Ivy aficionados. Does she control plants with a machine?
Mm-hmm.
I thought she just...
Back then she did.
Did she use a machine? Okay.
Originally, she didn't have the power. She just had the being resistant to like toxins and stuff.
Poison and pheromones and
stuff. She could put it on her lipstick and kiss.
Yeah.
But so she was more of a scientist originally in her original debut. So she had more of a stuff. And if you look at, I think it was the 1978 calendar where we also had Batgirl and Robin fighting Poison Ivy and Plant Master. And again, she had her
gun.
Device.
And
and if you look at her appearance in Justice League in the Injustice Gang, I think the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sean, I like this guy. He's right in our wheelhouse.
I know.
I've read way too much stuff is what it was.
Right in our wheelhouse, 1978 calendars.
I've actually, and now I'll plug another stupid thing. So back in the early 2000s, I was part of a Yahoo group of a DC fan fiction, Fiverse Project. It was the whole, if the crisis happened, but the Earths stayed apart, continuing stories. I took my calendar and wrote times past stories for every one of those things, taking Bob's things and giving him credit for the outlines, but then fleshing them out into, 10 page stories.
Is that accessible nowadays? Could we put a link to that?
If you look for on the internet for the Five Earths Project, Google that. They've moved out of the Yahoo group, but the person who is doing the whole thing has actually put the stories out there. So you can see all my horrid fan fiction for DC Comics, and then you guys can judge.
That's getting the link in the show notes.
Whether or not, if you need, I'll find it for you.
I love those DC calendars. I absolutely love those.
Oh, yeah. I loved them too. And I had those on my wall forever. I think I still may even have the calendar somewhere around here.
It's 1978. That's good this year, right? Because I have the Spider-Man calendar. Maybe it's 77. I can't remember. Every 6 or 7 years, however it is, I hang it up because it works for this year. In part two, I love how the Huntress was talking about how Catfish is not as good a player on Earth 2 as he is on Earth 1. I thought that was really... That was the baseball fan, Bob Rzakis, putting a little nod in there. I thought that was really cool. I got to ask, when Catfish does this spin move to knock down Catwoman, it took me like 3 or 4 times looking at the panel to understand it. It looked to me at first like she was running around him, like the Flash running.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a poor panel.
It almost looks like when you're dancing and you do the twist, how you keep your arm, how you keep your fists like in front of your chest. If you extend your arms, that's what it looks like he's doing.
Yeah. And by extending his arms, he ended up breaking out of it at the same time.
Yeah.
It is a little bit of a confusing thing. And I'm realizing, looking where the word bubbles, that took me a minute to go, is that Catwoman doing saying that? Or was it?
It's a poorly constructed sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to part three. I thought Babs was a little sarcastic, a little out of character. My dad didn't go around Gotham in long underwear. Would you come ask me about what kind of bat makeup to use? I don't know. I thought that was a little out of character for her. She's usually a little more generous. Now she turns it around. They become friends, of course.
I agree. Yeah, I think so too. I do think it's I think this is because of the story length, that you get to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 5 panels of them just talking.
And
in the best way, this isn't forwarding the story. This isn't laying plot devices for later. This is just characterization.
And this, Don Heck is fine, right? He draws relatively attractive women. It's not great, but it's, Sean's waving his hand at me. I'm trying to find something positive here.
The backgrounds, if you look at it, I'm looking at it, I can see that as being a very valid carnival fair type of environment.
That's true.
It reminded me exactly everything.
Definitely
is a bit more of the Marvel, I think, style into there, being able to take that separation and doing a little bit of a characterization between the fights. So
Kathy's got a nice move on page 20 where she does a somersault through a window to take on Madame Zodiac. I thought she still got it. I thought that was a pretty good move.
I think that's fantastic.
I'm going to nitpick on that, because when she says in panel 2, the mysterious Madame Zodiac looking for some palms to read, nobody has mentioned Madame Zodiac up to this point. How does Batwoman know her name? I had to go back and look. Did Catwoman or Poison Ivy say anything in the intervening scenes?
There is a sign that says Madame Zodiac.
But she didn't know that she was connected to
that's
villains.
True. Yeah.
I think Bob is just like, I'm at the end of the story and I need to give Kathy to say something.
A good catch. Yeah, she must be the bad guy because she's out here.
So I can make some puns about stars and in the cards and whatever. And it's like, again, 12-year-old me wouldn't have caught that at all. 57-year-old, 58-year-old me would go, wait a minute.
I do like that they're trying to set up. I mean, presumably she's, the idea would be that she'd be a recurring threat. Coming up with new villains is always good. So I do like that. I agree with you, Sean. You said something about she can be interesting. I think she's got the potential to be interesting in the future. So we'll give Bob a B+ on Madame Zodiac.
I wanted to check into this because I'm going, didn't remember all of her power stuff. It's been a long time. So I'm like, let me go to my who's who. And I realized she's not in there. And then I went, who's whose rule was more than two appearances in order to make a character show up in the original who's who run. So I'm like going, okay, so that probably reminded me maybe she only appeared one more time and that was it, and she never got a who's who entry, which
that's
kind of surprising.
Yeah.
She doesn't even get a warrant a link on Mike's Amazing World. I just looked. And it's got the villains in the story of Catwoman and Poison Ivy, doesn't even mention Madame Zodiac.
Now, if Roy Thomas was writing this, Madame Xanadu and Madame Zodiac would be sisters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or rivals.
All right. So that was fun. You guys ready to move on?
Yes, we are.
All right. We're going to talk now bat branding. In this segment, we're going to talk about the non-story pages in this issue. So we're going to start out. We didn't mention it because it doesn't really go with the first story, but the splash page of this issue. Now, I'll say this. Over in Superman Family, you'd usually get a Kurt Schaffenberger image of the Superman family doing something fun with a title of each of the stories. Jimmy Olsen in this, Lois Lane in that. But here, instead, we get a pinup by Jim Starlin, of all people, of Batman standing on a cliff, sort of menacing, growling at us, really kind of scary looking, with a poem. Now, I have to read the poem because it's pretty cool. And that's it. There's no other purpose. It's just a pinup. When the cold wind howls and the wild wolf growls, the light of day grows dim. From the earth's dark bowel, in a cape and cowl, stalks a figure solemn and grim. His visage is awesome. It's sheer terror to cross him. The evilest men blanch with fear. But the innocent praise him. No villain can faze him. 'Tis justice and law he reveres. The Batman. I'm thinking about getting that put on my gravestone.
Did they credit, I can't remember, did they credit who wrote the poem?
No, I don't see any credit for it. There's nothing on Mike's Amazing World. I don't know.
Because I will tell you, on the DC Universe app, that page is not included.
It's not included.
I'm like going, oh, I had to go back and find it online.
Yeah.
To refresh myself.
It is not in the app. So we'll definitely include the scan of it in the show notes.
So Bat Cousins, remember back when you used to like me? The poem, I like the poem. I understand that Starlin is a fantastic artist. I do understand that intellectually. I think this drawing of Batman is horrible. I do think it's really horrible because of the proportions. That leg, I don't know what that leg is doing.
I don't know what his right leg is doing.
It's such an odd angle. And then his arm, like if you would pull his arm down, wouldn't it go like halfway almost to his, I don't like this drawing at all.
Well, I thought you were going to say almost makes him look like a villain. I mean, he looks really scary with his face and his menace. Mm-hmm.
I like the bats. I like the purple into the blue. Mm-hmm. I like that. But I just think that picture is, the drawing is horrible.
Yeah, I'm not quite so negative on it. I like it okay, but I mainly really love the poem. The poem was cool.
Yeah. Okay, so we are going to go on to a super, super cool ad, and we are going to stop the presses. Now, you can read all about it in DC's new monthly newspaper, Direct Currents. If you remember anything about this ad, you remember the lineup. It starts with Superman, and then kind of like going in a semicircle behind him is Wonder Woman, Batman, Huntress, Flash, Black Lightning, Shade, the Changing Man, Firestorm, like a little bit of space, and then Sergeant Rock. Is this Joe Staton? This is Joe Staton.
This is definitely Joe Staton. Yes.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Look at all those new characters in that. Huntress, Firestorm, Shade, Black Lightning's not that much older than them. That's pretty impressive.
I did a search for this version of Direct Currents. I couldn't find anything online. Bat Cousins, if you have any of these, please post a link of these photos. Is it possible that this didn't come out?
Could be. I remember the ads. I don't remember ever sending in for this.
Because it's like a newspaper, a newsletter.
I don't know, Sean. That's a good point.
Now, I remember a version of Direct Currents that was they used to get out of the comic shops in the early to mid 80s.
Yeah.
Right.
And they came out once a month and you had to pay like 25 cents for it. But it covered basically synopsises of what's coming out in the month with some cover shots. So I remember those.
And Amazing World of DC Comics had the Direct Current, which was like a listing. I tried to find this version online. I tried like eBay and Google, and I couldn't find it. So if any of the listeners actually have a copy or know where it could, I would love to see them.
Yeah, I think this is another casualty of the we talked about with the DC Superstar Society, just not enough people signing up. And then they had worse things to worry about when the implosion hit 6 months from now.
Our next one is Superman in the Big Fall, and it is a Hostess ad. And this is probably like the most straightforward Hostess ad there is, because Clark Kent uses his X-ray vision, sees that elevator is going to fall. The elevator falls. He zooms up and catches it. And to calm the kids down, he throws a bunch of Hostess cupcakes to them. And then they say, "We were calm, cool, and collected because we had our Hostess cupcakes." There's no villain. There's no, silliness. It kind of is just straightforward.
Next up, it's Dollar Comics Action. I won't go into detail about it. Sean gave us a great history of Dollar Comics. And it has a picture of this very issue of Batman Family, along with that fabulous World's Finest number 250 with the heroes smashing through prior issues of World's Finest.
The next page we're going to talk about is Batmail Family. And as always, we are inviting Mike White, Scott Gibson, and Beverly Thawne onto the show. You can follow in the footsteps of our very own letter writer, Martin, right here. Yeah. We would love to have you on the show. A lot of cool things. Letters about old superheroines never die. They just fade away. There is also, inspired by Paul reading the poem, I'm actually going to read the entire letter by Beverly Thawne because it is fantastic. Dear editor, on page 3 of Cinematech, when Kirk Langstrom says, "What is this tripe?" he should have been referring to your preschool attempt at writing. A better title would have been Gastrointestinal Attack. Not only have you wasted one of our greatest resources using trees to make the paper your crap is printed on, you also have made a mockery of one of our modern miracles, the boob tube. And your so-called art is no better. The penciling needed an eraser, and the inks looked like they were done by a quadriplegic squid. Boogity, 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 boogity. Oof. Now that I've exorcised the demon within me that wrote all of those untrue statements, I'm free to tell you what I really thought. I loved it. Cinematech is the funniest thing I've seen since some guy pulled a cross on Count Yorga and got knocked in a quicksand pit. The characterization of Ambrose Robertson, complete with a Frankenstein t-shirt, captures the true meaning of the word fanatic. My only regret is that Ambrose didn't throw hair remover in Man-Bat's face and say, "That's how they got rid of the werewolf." You have truly given me a good laugh. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to get back to my sarcophagus before some aspiring archaeologist digs me up and puts my Minnie Mouse watch in a museum. That was fantastic.
That was a great letter.
Great letter.
It's fantastic. Captures the spirit of that great story. Fantastic. We would love to have you on the show.
Yeah, Beverly. Yeah, that was a great letter. We also get a Batmail Family special delivery this issue. And this time we got letters on the Huntress's debut in DC Superstars number 17. And we will invite Ed Villa, Mike Tiefenbacher, and Beth Montaloni, if you are listening, to come on the show. Ed Villa loved the debut. He says, "This then was the real strength of the first Huntress story, a character who leaves a life of wealth and comfort to enter one of lurking peril and moral bankruptcy." She did it much in the same way as her father, and she goes on. I thought he had a pretty good letter. Not as good as Beverly's letter, but pretty good. Mike T, though, did not like the motive for her becoming a costumed adventurer, since it's sort of the same as everybody, if somebody gets killed. Yeah. He wanted to see more of Helena's childhood and earlier life. And we get a little bit of that in her own strip coming up. And then Beth, the last one, is sort of the opposite, fitting successor and all that kind of stuff. So it was interesting, little mini debate on the Huntress's debut. Of course, DC Superstars didn't run letters about those side of things. Here's where we got letters on the Huntress's debut, which I thought was cool.
I think that's really cool that they did that. Our next ad is a half-page ad, and it is all new and in paperback. And these are the black and white paperback reprint by Tempo Books featuring Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, Justice League of America, World's Finest.
John's got them all.
And Superboy and the Legion, which I don't have. That sound you heard. So I lifted up all of these paperbacks that I have, and I'll include them, I guess, in a picture for the gallery. So I don't have Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. I'd like to get it. I checked eBay. They're kind of too much for what I would pay for them. Maybe I'll get that, maybe not. But yeah, they are really cool. At the time like these came out, I did have Superman, which I think, I'm not exactly sure. I think I got this through a book club. Like a school book club. And then I also had World's Finest. Oh my God. I had this one summer and I must've read this 13,000 times because I loved it so much.
Well, I think it's cool that some of these are like word finds and stuff. So they're puzzles. Probably Bob Zachis did them.
Well, I didn't even get into that. So what we were talking about are just quote unquote, just panel cut-ups. Like a comic book page won't really fit on a paperback page. So they cut up the panels. And then they have maybe two or three panels from each story on that page. They're great. I wholeheartedly recommend them. Then on the other side are the puzzle books, the superhero puzzle books. And the thing is, like, they are so hard to find. You are never, ever going to get a boxed set of the puzzle books, like the one I'm holding in my hands.
I've never even seen that.
It is a boxed set. It's just like clip art on the front. I guess that's the Neil Adams, right? Superman breaking. Is this Infantino, Batman and Robin?
Looks like it, yeah.
Yeah, that's standard.
The Wonder Woman standing there. And I'll include a picture. And on the back is four of the books that are included inside the box. So when you buy it from eBay, make sure that the inside contents are the same that's listed on the box. Because you might get different books inside, like I did. Now, they are all the superhero puzzle books, but they are different ones. Now,
oh, interesting.
I don't know if I mind it so much because one of them is Super Friends.
Right.
And I would rather have had the Super Friends, which isn't in the box. So the boxed set has Batman and Robin's Fun with Numbers. And that actually was in my box. The next one is Wonder Woman's Crime Busting Clues and Codes. That was in my box. It was Superman Search a Word Shapes, which was in my box. Superman's Maze Challenge was not in my box. But Super Friends Word Finds and Scrambled Word Finds, that was in my box. And I think there's one other one. Batman's Super Villains Mazes.
Very cool.
So I'll have to go on eBay and look up. But they're really neat. It's all just art that's just clipped out from different issues. And then like they have little puzzles on each one.
Now, were the puzzles done?
Yeah. A lot of them were. I understand.
Yeah. It's hard to find those. I remember getting some of those Marvel Fun and Games
magazines.
I had those comics back in the day, and I've got a couple of years ago. I'm like, oh, I want to find those. Yes. And then I'm disappointed when you get the ones that are actually done. And I'm like, oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, if you're hunting on eBay, make sure that the eBay seller. Now, I specifically write an email saying, can you please assure me that each page is not written on? That may just save yourself.
Hard to find.
Now, the next thing we're going to talk about, did you miss any of these fantastic DC tabloids? Order today while supplies last. You can order Superman versus Muhammad Ali, The Best of DC Treasury, Superman versus Wonder Woman, Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, Batman, which is the Ra's al Ghul Treasury, and Rudolph, one of the 1800 Rudolph treasuries that they had. Sorry, Martin Gray. We're going to talk about Rudolph for 20 minutes now.
I know. Martin did not like us talking about Rudolph so much.
Oh, my good old cousin Martin.
Not you, Martin. Yes, not Martin.
No, no, I know cousin Martin, Martin quite well. Martin and I have been long time friends on Twitter. He and I go way back.
And then the last page is a DC feature page, a Bob Zachis special, I'm sure. And it's got two halves to it. One is a profile. It's DC Profiles number 30. We haven't gotten any of these yet in Batman Family because this is our first dollar comic. I don't know if they ran it in other comics as well as dollar comics. I think they did, but I don't know. Anyway, we get Cary Burkett, which I kind of had forgotten about him. And it was interesting to read the story of where he was at the time. Again, it doesn't say who wrote it. It probably was Bob. It said he was a mild-mannered assistant editor who stalks the stage and was also an actor, which I thought was neat. He was another one of these guys that stuck in New York, walked into DC's office and got hired Paul Levitz's assistant. just on the bat. I love those stories. And then the bottom half of the page is the answer man. Well, of course, our bat cousin, Bob Rozakis. There are several questions about whatever happened to this category. Kids didn't have the internet back then. You know, whatever happened to these people? Leo Dorfman, a lot of them were artists. And what happened to them? Another one about how many Earths there are. And Bob, I always love that. And then the ever-present, hey, how do I get back issues of your comics questions? We don't have them! They ought to just print that on every DC comic. So, fun feature page.
All right. Paul, have you ever heard of a person named Vanessa Williams?
I have.
She is a singer, and her biggest song probably is Save the Best for Last, and that is exactly what this issue did.
Yeah.
Because we are going to talk about the third story, which is There's a Demon Born Every Minute, and it stars Man-Bat with guests Demon and cameo appearances by Batman, Batgirl, and Huntress. 19 pages written by Bob Rozakis. Penciled by Michael Golden. Inked by Michael Golden. And this was later reprinted in Legends of the Dark Knight, Michael Golden hardcover, 2019. I think I need to pick that up. Man-Bat and the Demon in There's a Demon Born Every Minute. This is the tale of a woman who shows up at a birth in order to throw a spell on a newborn baby. Bat cousins, we are watching Disney's Sleeping Beauty. But actually, Huntress's Earth One visit ends with a faulty JLA transporter tube breaking Morgane Le Fay out of the Phantom Zone. Instead of showering or getting something to eat, maybe three or so hamburgers, MLF highlights it to Jason Blood's apartment to look for the Philosopher's Stone. She finds it. Meanwhile, Kirk is waiting for Francine to go into labor. But before she does, some other lady gives birth to a green creature baby, Chag, just like in that fantastic scene in V. But the creature soon melts away from the child, leaving it safe. Jason Blood shows up. We can talk about how, because I don't get that at all. And quicker than you can say, Beelzebub's your uncle, another baby is born. This one being of the Charizard variety, but that doesn't stay around either. And a normal, dumb, regular baby is left to be cradled by a Zaddy Dilf. A demon I'd like to be friends with. Oh, by the way, Man-Bat has been flying around each delivery room all this time. Demon, realizing that this magazine is soon going to morph into Detective Comics, acts like a real Sherlock Holmes, puts two and two together, and realizes that Morgane Le Fay is the cause of all this falderall. Flying high over NYC, Man-Bat uses his Fadar to ping, ping, ping in on her location. One Kool-Aid Man visit through a window later, and the two heroes are letting Michael Golden have some layout fun while they battle it out with MLF. Unfortunately, she gets stoned, and Kirk gets back to the hospital in time to meet Rebecca Elizabeth Langstrom. Martin, what did you think of the story?
So I really like the through line of the Huntress's first visit in Earth One, and how we get tied up in these opening panels. And I like that her return trip home triggered the release of Morgane Le Fay out of wherever she had been sent. I thought Golden's art is really solid, very creepy and horror-like on this. That shot on page two, when we first see Morgan, I remember distinctly, this is how old school we used to do this. So when I wanted to copy comic book artwork, I used to have an old turntable with a plastic cover, clear plastic cover. I put my lamp on the floor,
The
plastic cover sit over the edge of my bed, put the comic page, and then I would trace the outline, and then I'd fill it all in, color it in, and put those pictures up on my wall. So I had comic book character pictures.
I bet your mom loved having her up on the wall in that outfit.
Well, that was fine until it got replaced with Farrah Fawcett and Barbie Benton.
By the way, for anyone who appreciates the womanly form, I know people who like that, like Slave Leia. I don't understand why Morgane Le Fay is not in cosplay for that interest group, because that outfit is spectacular.
Yeah, it's amazing. Right.
And I'll point it out, if you go to that third page, the interesting thing I love about this panel is you go from the first panel with Morgan, and then the two things with the guard, and then panel four, you actually follow the form, and Morgan's form shows that teleport, which I thought was a really cool artistic transition.
I thought this page was spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. She starts out in the museum and ends up in his office, but her body's in the same position. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
And you get it.
Oh, I did too. I mean, I probably didn't notice that again, young me, but now looking at it as an adult and appreciating the artwork. I'm like, that's amazing stuff. And that Demon Child on page 6, I remember that scared the bejesus out of me back then. I'm like, that is the freakiest thing I've ever seen.
If only it would have stuck its tongue out.
I mean, with the three eyes and the bulbous head. I mean, I know
the
babies,
mom in the corner is.
Yeah,
the mom is. I know babies have big bulbous heads. I remember that stuff, but it's like, and you know, that'll happen during delivery. You get that whole conical thing that eventually goes away, but still, it was like.
And on that page, Sean, you called it out. That must be an awfully big delivery room. Man, that is flying around dodging those canisters of oxygen or whatever they are.
It must be like one of those like medical theaters.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to give Cousin Bob a little bit of grief here because it's the 8th page of that story. And they were talking to the doctor in the delivery. And he says, I'll vouch for Mr. Mambat on that officer. Mrs. Langley gave birth to a child. I'm going, Bob, Langley is close to Langstrom. You couldn't come up with a different name for the one throwaway for this mother? Too much Lang on the brain.
I try not to disagree with guests.
Uh-oh.
Last month, Bob Rozakis couldn't even give a name to the villain of the issue. So I don't care if he would have called her Mrs. Langstroms. He gave her a name. I'm happy with that.
Well, okay, so I'm not going to blame Bob. Then I'll blame Al Milgram as the editor, right? Who could have went, Bob, we need to kind of change that. Yes, Al Milgram. There we go. So I'll blame it on Al. But other than that, loved this story. It was really good.
So this was my introduction to the demon.
Mm-hmm. No.
Probably mine too. Unless he was in Brave and the Bold before this.
Mm-hmm.
This might be the only complaint I have about this story. So I wouldn't have known it at the time, but the demon doesn't rhyme in this issue.
He did not rhyme back then.
Oh.
They were just talking about this on the FW Team Up podcast, Sean. If you haven't listened to that one yet, Siskoid and Rob, they were trying to figure out when he started rhyming. The other thing that's not in here that I noticed is there's no gone form of man.
Well, I thought that was rhyming, so yeah.
Yeah, so somebody, I guess, other than Jack Kirby came up with that stuff. But yes, he's always cooler when he rhymes, no question
about
it.
You definitely want to go back and read the old Demon, and I'm pretty sure that's been collected, if I'm not mistaken. That was not a book. I remember seeing those issues. I will commit sacrilege. I was not a huge Kirby fan when he did some of his DC work, so I did not follow that title.
Yeah, me either.
I agree, yeah.
A lot of it was when we were just a little too young, too.
Yeah. I probably
because
couldn't
appreciate it. Early 70s. It's not what we would have gravitated to and picked it up on the newsstand.
Oh my God, I'm going to be 55 in August. How much older do I have to be?
No, I meant at the time, Sean, you know, a 7-year-old isn't, I don't think he's going to gravitate to liking Demon.
I understand Kirby's place in comics history and it's
me too.
Deserved and earned and all of that. There's artwork as a kid that I didn't like that I can go back and appreciate and think, oh, that's beautiful. Kirby just, especially like DC Kirby, I just am not like the squared off fingers and like when Martin said, oh, you should go back and read the Demon. I'm like, do I have to read the
book? Read it for the story. I will give you that. And that gives you the context. But yeah, there was definitely some weird stuff going on in that book. I've recently reread it probably maybe 5-6 years ago.
I loved how on pages 11 to 12, there's no fight. These two characters haven't met before and the demon just blasts his story into Kirk's head. I thought that was super cool. But then I have to call out on page 13, I have never forgotten it my whole life. It's probably my second favorite panel of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First favorite panel, first time I read it, is the panel in Watchmen when Ozymandias says I did it 35 minutes ago. But this panel where the cop turns to the other cop and says, cripes, whatever happened to heroes who look like heroes? Those two are the ugliest suckers I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I have loved that. I mean, the expression on his face, you could just see a Gotham cop saying that. And they are two ugly dudes.
And tying this in with the letter column, someone writes in a letter about that. And they even reprint that panel in the letter column.
Oh, very good. Well, we'll get to that.
So I almost could see that as a commentary on comics in the 70s, because of the 70s, you were starting to get more of the horror comics. You were starting to get all this stuff that wasn't code anymore. And now you're starting to get heroes who didn't look like heroes, didn't wear the tights, it wasn't the clean lines and everything else. So if that was Bob's subtle way of making a commentary, kudos to Cousin Bob.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Martin. I am getting used to his Man-Batty sense now, Sean. So it didn't even bother me. But look at, again, we can go on and on about the great art, but look at the detail on page 14. Look at her table. She's got like a couch with things, and then there's like a table with the Philosopher's Stones on it. And the table is the face of another demon carved out to make a table.
Mm-hmm. It's called Demon Chic.
Demon Chic. I love it. And then the fight sequence, 15 and 16 are great. She gets turned into stone. That is creepy. First, I thought she was salt and they were going to like tip her over, you know, but then
they were going to put her out in the forest as a salt lick. So we didn't really talk right there where Morgaine turns into a stone, like the wording, like the all throughout the issue, like all of the, oh my gosh, I can't even think.
Sound
like
effects?
The sound effects. So the page before that, where like the giant hand grabs Man-Bat and you see his scree has lines coming off of it. We haven't even gone beat by beat. And I don't know that we have to.
Need to.
You know, it's Morgaine's at the hospital. She's going to graft a demon onto each baby that's born. It doesn't take. In the absolute best way, I think you wouldn't necessarily need to have dialogue balloons. And you would understand 90-95% of this story because the artwork is just that strong.
It ends with a beautiful portrait of the baby. And you think, oh, great, a happy ending to baby. And then Bob has to remind us that maybe baby Langstrom is going to be a demon. What? That really was a great twist.
It's not enough having the bat serum in both of your parents. And then you get that. You might also have a demon in you.
But that's such a beautiful last page. That last page is so gorgeous. So
it is.
Despite all of Golden's ability to do all that horrific art that he could do, this also shows another side of him as an artist, which I thought was really, which is why I appreciate him and why, you know, when he went over to Marvel and did Micronauts, now he's doing sci-fi and it's just always loved his art.
He's got the little baby bracelet that says
that's
Langstrom,
what I was going to say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fantastic story. I absolutely love it. In a book that has great stories, this is my favorite story. I just, you know, Bob Ruzakis just did a fantastic. The marriage of Bob Ruzakis and Michael Golden, I just think it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Despite the lackluster art in the second story, this is just a great comic book all around. Three pretty completely different stories.
Yes.
Yeah.
A great package.
Listeners, if there's something you didn't like about this story, bring it up. I'm sure I can no prize a way out of it. Bat Cousins, if there's a particular panel that you thought was great that we didn't talk about, let us know. We didn't even talk about, so Martin Gray, I don't know if you're going to be upset about the Man-Bat and Demon not really logos, but I think that looks great. It isn't their logos, but it's very distinct. It's
Demon had a logo, right? He had a comic.
Yeah.
Book. Oh yeah. It's
fairly reminiscent. I think the flames on his normal logo would have been too much because of the panel. I think stripping those things off probably helped.
So I started this segment talking about Vanessa Williams, Save the Best for Last. That song is way too slow to be played at a disco. So we're going to turn up the disco spinning ball and the effects. And we are going to go to Gabriel's Horn. Gabriel's Horn is the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 70s. And we're going to talk about the most 1970s moments in this issue from the stories. I definitely want to go last this time. I hope. My 70s moment is not stolen by anyone. I will jump out of this window if it is.
How do you want to do it? Story by story? What do you want to do?
How about if we go Martin first, do story by story? Do you have anything from the 70s in the first story?
First story, I have two. And this is not necessarily 70s. I've actually seen it since, but it was around that time. The sunken family room in the residential penthouse of Wayne Tower on pages 8 and 10. Sunken family rooms don't happen as much anymore, but they were very 70s.
Yeah, very good
one.
My other one in that story, on page 11, Dick calling the hotel clerk a turkey. He just needed a jive in there. And totally in there. Turkey was an insult in the 70s, and by golly, it still works. So those are my two for first story.
Well, that's a good one. Do you want me to go now, Sean, or do you want to just...
I'll go. The Man-Bat story is the one that had the super 70s one. So kind of like Freak Show and treating people like that. Yeah. That's kind of the only one I really... Other than like amusement parks and carnivals and that kind of thing being popular, but that I didn't have a lot for the first story.
Yeah, I had just the security monitor machine that Alfred's looking at on page 6 with the big dials and buttons in the screen.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good one. On page 11, got the guy with a pipe, talked about smoking before. So I didn't have a ton of them. Yeah. You know, the van breaking down, you know, that's kind of silly. So I didn't have a whole lot. How about story number 2, Martin?
Story number 2, I just got one thing. On pages 14 and 15, you see this twice. 50 cents for consultations and fortunes. Nice.
Yes.
And I love the whole continuity of how that panel carried over. I didn't mention that before, but I love that.
Yeah.
So yeah, yes. That's the closest 70s I could get into that story.
That's an excellent one. Mine was the fact that you've got this multinational contingent. There's no security, and you know, maybe they're mannequins or something down left below. And then I looked up, Bab says something about the Day of the Triffids. So I was like, what is that? Apparently, it is a 1951 post-apocalyptic novel that was adapted into a 1962 feature film of the same name. I did not know that. But so that doesn't really count because that's the 50s and 60s. Then getting on the flight, of course, with no ID. I mean, here's Helena, comes from Earth 2, got no, you like that one, Sean?
Ooh, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. I mean, not only is she walking up the staircase, which they still have.
I think that's only at very, very small airports and for basically like commuter flights. But based on the amount of people that are going on this, this is like a jumbo jet, but they're still, so I had that one. But you're right about that one.
She got the staircase and the fact that the guy is standing there signing autographs, the delay. My most one for the issue was the fact that Catfish Turner is obviously a reference to Catfish Hunter, who played for Kansas City and Oakland, but by the 70s played for the Yankees. Obviously was on the mind of baseball fan Bob Rozakis when he was probably sitting there at home trying to think out what kind of villain could I dig with Catwoman. And then he saw Catfish Hunter on the TV. It's like, oh, here we go. That's what I had for the second story, Sean.
And Bat great grandchildren. I can tell you, as a child of the 70s, like, I didn't care about sports. I didn't like sports. I hated sports. But even I knew who Catfish Hunter was.
Everybody
and
did.
Certainly understood. Basically, my 70 spot was like the airport. So we're going to move on to There's a Demon Born Every Minute.
You should get to go first so we don't take yours.
I want to save it just in case.
Okay. You may be mad at me.
I know.
Page 4, smoking in hospital waiting rooms. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The existence of the waiting room for the husbands.
Yes. Just the fact that they're there doing nothing. Yeah. They're smoking and not doing anything. That would not be around today. Yep. Nope.
And then for me, the other one was page 8 and 9. Jason Blood's very 70s fashion. What pimp catalog did he buy that out of? Just needed a hat.
I often talk about Michael Golden's art having action and fluidity. Jason Blood's coat has weight. You can feel the weight of that fur on the lapels.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Golden was great with of the time fashion for his characters.
So I had just a couple smaller ones on page 3, and it shows up a little bit later. Is it yours, Sean?
Oh, you're killing me, Paul. You're killing me.
Go ahead. Well, then I won't even say it.
No. Go ahead.
There's on the phone.
Yes.
What was that?
So, listeners, on the phone, there is one of these plastic attachments that you put on the handset of the phone so you can put it on your shoulder.
Your shoulder cradle.
Is that what they call it, a cradle? Sorry, Sean. This is what happens, Martin, when we're sitting here, we're like pouring over these, trying to outdo each other.
Well, I looked at that one and I'm going, I had to think and going, what in the world? Is that just like a weird, because I remember what the princess phones look like. My mom had one of those princess phones, but I'm like, what? In a resident, in an office, I remember seeing those, but not residents.
But it does go to show the detail that he puts into
thinking.
It.
Yeah.
The only other thing I'll mention is at the end, I mentioned that bracelet and I just saw it when I looked at the bracelet. Nowadays, you don't just get the name, you get a barcode on the baby's wrist. So I thought that was neat. But yeah, the phone was a good one. So sorry, Sean. Did you have anything else?
That's it. That was my shining star, my shining 70s star.
Well, you have to remember, too, back in the 70s, nobody was worried about identity stuff. I remember going to college in the 80s, and your grades with your social security number were posted outside the door.
Jeez.
And your college ID had your social security number on it.
Wow.
Are we sure you're really Martin Manson?
Yeah, no, I've still got the ID to prove it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm just wondering if you took it from somebody else. And,
No.
And the real Martin is lying in the forest. In a...
No. And you will see when you get to 481, when you look at the letter column, the addresses are there. Somebody could have written to me, whatever. I remember. I'm like, yeah, that's my old address.
All right, there you go. On that positive note, I think we've wrapped it up for the issue. We want to thank our special guest, Martin Menza, for stopping by the reunion. Martin, thank you very much. Could you please remind people how they can get in touch with you on the internet?
I would be happy to do that. Paul, folks can find me online, usually MC Menza, and I will spell that MC, my first and middle initials, MAENZA. Most of the socials, most predominantly on Twitter. I also have, I'd mentioned I did fan fiction for the Five Earths Project, which I'll get you guys the link. I have a blog that I used to do for many years called Martin's View at mcmenza.blogspot.net. Again, how original am I? I stuck with that and kept it since my AOL days. I used to do daily album reviews there a long time ago, and now I do mostly my book reviews, which I mirror over from Goodreads. So if you find me on Goodreads, friend me. I love sharing ideas as a librarian. It also always helps me to see new stuff or books. So feel free to reach out.
We'll play a podcast promo, and when we return, Sean and I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
In 2011, the Irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire and Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire and Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain team up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 16, Hamburgers, an Unnamed Villain, and a Green Boot. But before we get started, I have a quick story. You know how in like those Bugs Bunny cartoons, he would stand by the mailbox and fill out an order form, put the order form in, and then the postman would come up and bring him his package? Well, about 20, 35 minutes ago, we were talking about the Batman Special Spectacular, the dollar comic with Michael Golden art. Well, in that time between now and then, I sent away for my Batman Spectacular, and I got it through eBay. Yay! Now, I haven't started reading it yet, but I'll do that on vacation, so I can't wait to get into that. Now, we want to point out that we're still welcoming guests for the reunion. Please let us know if you are interested in being on the show. And you can be on the show for the whole show, or if you just want to do certain segments, that's fine too. We'll work it out. And we still have room for guests for Batman Family 19, and then flipping over to Detective Comics 482 and 484 and beyond. Okay, let's get to your comments from last month. First up, Bucky 749. Hello, old chums. It's Cousin Bucky and Jeremy, along with Mario and Jericho. Mario is cooking some of his world-famous brisket and combining that with turkey burgers with a cranberry barbecue sauce on sourdough buns. Jeremy is playing with puppies Cousin Alfred brought. Another great show. And later on, Bucky adds, Man from Atlantis. Swish. I've read two issues, and I've read two of the novels, and my brother and I have reviewed a couple of episodes and the TV movies. Thanks, Bucky. Check out our Bat Cousins if you want more Man from Atlantis. Captain Entropy pipes in, Bucky, you had me at brisket.
Bat Cousin Lizanne Oswalt stops by the reunion. Impressive podcast, most impressive. I wonder if this counts as Dial V for villain. The cover works pretty well. I'm assuming the main villain is using TV monitors of taped editions of him facing the two heroes. It's good to see the TV star duel a dent. I did enjoy watching the first episode of Gotham Knights. The actress on that show played Duel well, but enough about that CW show. So Sean, breaking in here, I have not watched that yet. I have like 5 episodes DVR'd and I haven't watched it yet. Have you watched it at all?
I haven't watched it literally like until I read this. I didn't even realize there was a Gotham Knights TV show. And since then, I've not heard anything about it. So if I hear good things about it, I'll probably, when I binge watch a show, I don't watch episode after episode after episode after episode. I like prefer what I call the syndicated version where I'll watch an episode a day.
Yeah.
I like watching it that way better. That's the way I consume a show or binge it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's up our alley. Apparently, Batman is dead. He's got a foster or illegitimate son, not sure which, who nobody knew about. Brand new character. And then the supporting characters are Dula Dent, Harper Row, which was from the more modern Batman comics, Carrie Kelly, you know, from The Dark Knight. It's like Note to Grayson or even, I don't know who's in it. So I don't know that it's quite our alley, but I owe it to at least check it out because it is Batman family.
I guess this takes place on Earth CW.
Yeah. Well, I don't know where Earth it's on, but anyway, back to Luzanne. I think Lori is ignoring Dick, not because she's mad at him, but because he's dressed just like the Keebler elf. I like green as much as the next person, but come on, was this from Kermit the Frog collection? As for Robin saving that burger that he hates, well, he is a college student. If you paid for it, you're going to keep it. On to the next story. Believe it or not, Barb looks fine in her yellow and white ensemble, though the villain looks like an escapee from a G.I. Joe comic. Then Barbara had to put on that mustard yellow monstrosity. The frills and such should work, but for whatever reason, it's just no. Is it weird that Babs is wearing a polka-dotted outfit and the only thing anyone notices is that she dyed her hair green? Weird that everybody thinks it's a set error instead of her just changing her hair color. The next story is not bad. I'm glad to see that Daddy Man Bat gets part of the reward. I will leave Francine's outfit out of the discussion since she is pregnant. And as for Kurt walking around with no shirt, it was a thing. The Man-to-Man looked like something out of a 70s Doctor Who episode. Can't wait to hear the next episode. Thanks, Luzanne.
Network All-Star and Bat Godfather Rob Kelly is with us as well. And he says, hey, Sean, please start stocking comics. With its inherent Christmas theme, it can run during the month's Mountain Comics is off. Perfect. I had one of those watches you guys mentioned. The Batman one, I think. Oddly, Captain Marvel is pictured on the inside of the box, even though he is not mentioned in the ad. Odd. What else is there to say about Michael Golden's work? Even at this early stage, he is doing phenomenal stuff. The contrast with Don Heck's stuff in the lead feature does Heck no favors. Somehow, this month his figures are even more lightweight and gossamer than usual. Great show as always. To which Brian Schufo says, I second the Stocking Comics podcast idea.
So moving on, we knew we'd get a comment on this topic, so we turned to our Bat Family optometrist, Mark Baker Wright, to set us straight. Okay, so let's talk about color blindness. I can only assume that Sean has never seen an Ishihara test, which most folks may not know by name, but which is very common. Basically, you're looking at a circle made of lots of similarly colored dots and are asked to identify a number within the pattern. If you're not colorblind, you should be able to discern the number. But if you have the specific type of colorblindness the test is set up to detect, you won't be able to make out the number because your eyes can't discern the difference between the specific colors, such as red and green being presented. And then he's gave a link to what the Ishihara test is. Now, note that while red-green colorblindness is perhaps the most well-known, it is but one of several types of colorblindness. The upshot of all this is if you're the right type of colorblind or wrong, depending on your perspective, it's entirely plausible that a person normally seen with red hair may not look any different to the colorblind person if she suddenly had green hair. That person's eyes can't distinguish the difference that other people's eyes can see automatically. So what do you think about that?
First of all, Mark, thank you so much.
Yes, for thank you.
It. That is great. It's funny because he says, I can only assume that Sean has never seen an Ishihara test, which I didn't know the name of, but I had seen those. I didn't even realize that they were used for colorblind. I could always just see the number. I could see that number and I guess never read anything more.
That was just a test to make sure you knew your numbers, Sean.
I guess, yeah. So thank you for parsing that. And I'm glad to have this information. Like, it's really, really good. So I really appreciate that.
We provide a public service here as well as good food at the reunion. Well,
Mark does. I don't know that we do. Bat enemy of the shoe, Brian Schufo says, I never realized Bat-Girl had appeared again anywhere. I always assumed she was ignored once Barbara Gordon's character was created. I hope she shows up again. And this is Sean saying, from your lips to Bob Razakis's ear.
And Bat-Dr. Ange makes his first appearance at the reunion. Great episode. I'm always listening, but I don't always comment. Just know I love the show. Thanks a lot, Ange. A couple of comments.
Love the Dula Dent Joker's Daughter Harlequin review. I remember the I'm Two-Face's daughter reveal. I suppose Dula, the name, should have given it away. But I really love the Michael Golden discussion. I was a kid when I was reading these comics, and I didn't really care about the credits too much. In an upcoming issue, he draws a demon strip. It was the first time I had ever read about Etrigan, and his art blew me away as a kid. I know I went back to the credits and said, who is this guy? His work is incredible. Thanks to your review, I now have some new books to look for. I'll advise you to find a couple of his Mr. Miracle issues from the late 70s. Wild stuff. Well, thanks, Anz. Yes, everybody should know we appreciate you listening. We know not everybody can find time to comment. That's okay. But we love it when you do. So you also keep us straight when we make a mistake or need colorblindness lessons, for example. So thanks to everybody for being part of the family.
Back to comments. This one from Grumpy Bat Uncle Martin Gray. Ange, did you know the Englehart, Rogers, Gerber, Golden, Mr. Miracle run is now collected as a hardback? With bonus Brave and the Bold and DC Comics Presents material and the cover to the planned number 26. It came out in 2020 alongside the Conway Newton Return of the New Gods hardback. And don't you deserve a treat? To which Ange says, interesting, maybe I'll ask Santa. And I say, if Ange gets that for Christmas, we could cover it on Stalking Comics, my brand new 12-episode podcast miniseries. If not, then I can cover it on my new 12-episode podcast miniseries, Stay Golden, an appreciation of the works of Michael Golden. Back to Martin. Thanks for hosting another barbecue, Sean and Paul. But why so lonely this episode? Just put the call out and I'll be right beside you with my meaty sausages. That's what he said. Anytime, Martin. Let us know if there's a detective that you want in on. Back to Martin. I remember this issue. It was pretty fun. Maybe it's the digital reader adding slickness, but I think the art by Don Heck and John Salardo looked pretty darn nice. Even though Dick did look rather unusual in his civvies, and there's one close-up where he looks Asian American, and why not? And doesn't Don draw nice dogs in the first chapter? I know you like dogs. Now, this is Martin's quote, not my quote. Dogs are God's second greatest creation after cats. Do you reckon that Batman nabs Mad Hatter headline refers to Batman number 297 from March of 1978? We know Uncle Bob is good like that. Yes, Martin, I absolutely do think that. Great catch. And who cares if the undercover cops didn't get any dialogue? They were super hot and very well dressed. It's always great to see Dula and Bat Hyphen Girl. That Jason Bard logo is terrible.
You're doing the logos.
I'm sure someone could whip up one to match the Batgirl and Dick affairs. Pretty good story, though. Michael Golden isn't quite the Michael Golden yet. His faces aren't always successful, but he'll get there. The Michael Golden focus was, well, Golden. But I hope John Salardo turns up again in the credits. I want to hear his story. And then Martin adds, bring on those beautiful dollar comics.
Next up, we have our guest from this very episode, Bat Cousin Martin Menza. Hey, Bat Cousins. I certainly would have been spending time talking with Cousin Yvonne this month, anytime she was around. Thanks for getting it, Martin. Thanks for the Teen Titans recap. I was a huge fan of this era of the Titans. And I, too, love the idea of Titans West. I would have loved to see more of those folks, so much that I eventually wrote a series of Titans West tales for the DC fan fiction site I was part of back in the 2000s, the Five Earths Project. Check out the show notes. I put a link in there to the Five Earths Project. For all we know, Martin, maybe Mark Waid is using some of your stuff as inspiration for his new series coming out soon, World's Finest, The Teen Titans. What can we say? The Fire and Water Network asks, and the comics gods deliver. Back to Martin. I very much loved the Jim Aparo cover on this one. That was probably, for me, my favorite part of the issue. I did enjoy seeing both Harlequin and Bat-Girl appearing in the issue. Bat-Cousin Bob was doing a great job crossing over his titles by moving the characters around all the time. It made the world feel very connected. Looking forward to the Dollar Comics era, beginning with next issue. And thanks again for covering it with us, Martin.
Sub Gum Doug says, thanks for catching us up on Joe Doll's escapades in Titans since her last family outing. I haven't read these books. Do the Titans have an in-story reason for making her a Titan, given her not especially heroic showing in this book previously? If not, I applaud their being generous enough to offer her a membership.
So, Doug, to do that little summary, I just reread them all, and no, she just shows up with Robin and then just hangs around with him at Gabriel's Horn. That was it.
Some Gub Doug then says, how about Dula, though? She's moved on from the green wig game. So do we think Barbara got one from her? However, Batgirl got it. She makes it work. I think. She, the JLI's Beatriz, and Billie Eilish could go on the road as the Green Bees. I have some thoughts about the villain of the main story. Real name unknown, but also villain name unknown. But I guess his real job is being a videographer who would adjust a TV feed's color as needed in the course of his workday. I'm not sure that that's the right job to assign someone with color blindness. As to his villain name, well, I appreciate the alliteration in the story title, Fury of the 5-in-1 Foe, but his name has to be something catchier while still incorporating 5. And I'm inclined to reference how he keeps flubbing in all of his 5 personas. Guys, how about as a tribute to the outstanding dialogue found in Batman issue number 66, I'm going to call this guy the 5-way boner. Eh? Eh? I'm being told that I'm not allowed to name characters anymore. Very well. Ta-ta.
Next up, Bat Cousin Matthew Davis stops by the reunion. Ah, April, that time of year when all the cars have a nice chartreuse highlight from a layer of pollen. I loved your recap of Dula / Joker's daughter / Harlequin in the Ruzakas Teen Titans run. One plotline I remember from that era was the disappearance of Mal's horn.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that I don't think it was ever resolved, Matthew. Mm-hmm. When they announced the new Teen Titans in 1980, I wondered if they would revisit that hanging thread. Needless to say, they didn't, but Wolfman and Perez created one of my all-time favorite comics, so I'll let it slide. The first story of this issue is about as bland as the hamburgers Dick was eating. It had its moments, but I think the problem was the villain. Interesting concept with the changing identities, but overall, a few things caught my eye. The one dog tugging on Robin's cape is either trying to prove Edna Mode's mantra or decided that song lyrics don't apply because it isn't Superman. Wait a minute. Who was pumping garbage into the river behind the Ferris aircraft factory? What was Carol up to while Hal was gallivanting in space? Did she know? If so, what did Ollie have to say? And how did this villain get away with a jetpack without a Green Lantern after him? Oh yeah, Hal's gallivanting in space. Good timing, Lori. Gordon's listing the results of the disgraced sheriff's plan, and then she calls them in for dinner before he mentions the biggie, the train derailment. Whether it's the 1970s or today, that's still a big deal. I thought someone who's red and green colorblind sees red and green as gray, but I believe there are varying degrees of colorblindness. See earlier for the answer to that. A villain upset over a rigged election? Preposterous motivation. Now, I know people joke that so-and-so couldn't get elected dog catcher, but what town actually elects their dog catcher? According to Mike's Amazing World, this is the last appearance of Bat-Girl until she shows up at Wonder Girl's wedding in Tales of the Teen Titans, number 50, 7 years later. I don't think she was ever shown in action or dying in Crisis on Infinite Earths, and that included everybody. The Man-Bat story was much better. Great action and pacing fit in a lot fewer pages. Still loving Michael Golden's artwork. Still getting the feeling that Bob Ruzakas had a lot more freedom with Man-Bat than he did with Robin and Batgirl, and he was having fun writing this character.
Mm-hmm.
But I really have to ask, what the heck is a hamburgery? Is that a northern phrase? I can't remember hearing or reading that anywhere except in this story. Captain Entropy replied to that comment saying, I think it's hamburgeria. Anyway, back to Matthew. Most 70s things, yes, we have Jimmy Carter, payphones, and console TVs, but check out the watch ad you posted. The ordering coupon has spaces for credit card numbers if you're paying by Bank AmeriCard or MasterCharge. You'd have to put that in an envelope, drive to the corner in your Pacer and drop it in the mailbox to be more 70s. Great catch, Matthew. I love it. That was great.
Great job, Matthew. Bat Podcasting All-Star and co-host of the excellent JLU cast, Chris Franklin, is next up. Hey, cousins. I wrote an article on Titans West for Back Issue several years ago, issue number 65, and I interviewed Bob Ruzakas about his plans for the book. I'll check my copy or my original article file when I get home and get back to you on why Ruzakas may have introduced a larger team just issues before cancellation. I hate to beat up on Don Heck, who did some wonderful work at Marvel in the Silver Age, but his art, as printed, was pretty uninspired during this period, and it didn't help Teen Titans either. Maybe Babs and Dick threw those one-way studios, jointed cardboard figures advertised in comics at the time at the unnamed bad guy? Cindy currently owns a Wonder Woman. Speaking of merch, I still have my childhood Batman watch as advertised on the back cover. It doesn't work, but it still displays great. And of course, it's a bit too small for me to wear. I had the case for years, which my mom kept for me, but somehow along the way, it was lost.
Alas.
Oh, and Power Girl's design was actually created by Rick Estrada and Wally Wood with the boob window. Incoming publisher Jeanette Kahn hated the look, and Wood increasingly drew PG's breasts bigger. Wood closed up the window, but proceeded to increase Kara's size each issue to ridiculous proportions. When Joe Staton took over the art chores on All-Star Comics, he eventually gave her the swoop neck collar. Michael Golden drew one of the stories in the first Batman comic I clearly remember buying, or having bought for me, DC Special Series number 15, I Now Pronounce You Batman and Wife, was written by Denny O'Neill and is the tale where Batman is married to Talia while he's unconscious. Even at age 3, I knew this art was something special. He is also the artist of one of my favorite and unfortunately now forgotten Batman stories, The Player on the Other Side, from Batman Special number 1, early in 1984, written by Mark W. Barr. When he was doing covers for Detective in the early 90s, I was happy to see him back on the character. His Dark Knight is underrated, and he's great elsewhere, too.
I love it when Chris brings the knowledge.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris. I agree, that story about the Wraith is a great one. It's a good call out. Next up, we get comments from the Bat Captain Entropy. Sorry I'm so late with my homework, Professor Cannon and Professor Myers. There were so many good podcasts this week that I forgot I hadn't finished this one. And I missed the assignment in Modern Fire and Arms. Maybe you could cut me some slack since we're Bat Cousins. Seriously, y'all were very entertaining and informative as always, even though the stories might have left a little to be desired. And I really enjoyed the Easter ham at the reunion. I won't repeat all the praise from the comments above, just know that I agree with it. Regarding the question about the long gun sights, I think we're still talking about the shotgun from the Shotgun Sniper story, right? If so, the short answer is no, that's not a 70s thing because those sights are still in use. And then the captain provides an excellent lesson in the sights. I knew he would know all about it. Check out the comments for more technical explanation that he provides. He then closes with, thanks for another opportunity to learn, and then drone on. I mean, share my knowledge. Next time, I'll bring watermelon. Thank you, Captain. We always appreciate the knowledge here at the reunion.
Next up, Bat Cousin Brett Young. Hi, Bat Cousins. Sorry I'm late. I brought a basket of leftover Cadbury eggs from Easter. They always seem like a great nostalgic idea for a snack until you have one, and it feels like you just ate a melted candle. Enjoy! Oh, good. Another Don Heck issue. The Chainsaw Bandit was something. I'm not sure having a chainsaw for one hand and an axe for another makes for a particularly effective bandit. Maybe he should have brought along the regular hands bandit for assistance. I know I've harped on this before, but why is Dick always sabotaging his relationship with Lori? Again, the perfect college girlfriend is right in front of him, and Dick's busy running off with a sentient mom haircut who cosplays as his dad's worst enemy and thinks throwing a frisbee will stop a guy with a chainsaw. Come on, Dick. Get it together. You guys are 100% right on the train full of mannequins. Also, half of them look like Bruce Wayne. But let's credit Don Heck for giving Commissioner Gordon an incredibly flowing Wyatt Earp mustache. That white handlebar masterpiece looks like it could have wrapped around half of the grenade and chucked it out of the train while pouring Gordon two fingers of single malt with the other side. By the way, his dad joke about Red Grange wasn't great, but it was accurate. The Galloping Ghost was the guy who really put the NFL on the map by signing with the Chicago Bears. Before that, college football was way more popular and pro football was looked at as a sideshow. I'm pretty sure he was the first, or one of the first, elected into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. That's your sport ball for the day, Sean. So this is Sean C. Generally, I like when Brett Young writes in these letters, but I don't think I'll ever forgive him for having make me read sports stuff in my Batman Family Reunion podcast. But I'm going to forgive him and go on with the rest of his letter. This story had so many bizarre moments. I loved Barbara, Dick, and the rest casually noting the green boot while Batgirl was getting worked over on live TV, and then just stroll into the kitchen for coffee without figuring it out if she was really okay. When the Titans break up, they break up. And all this weird body moves and random leaping during the final fight with the bad guy was really distracting. Were they fighting in a bouncy house? Heck giveth Gordon's mustache, and he taketh away everything else. The most 70s moment has got to be public officials actually taking accountability for their actions. I could elaborate, but do I need to? Great spotlight on Michael Golden, Paul. One thing you didn't mention was his brief work on the G.I. Joe yearbooks. He drew a story about the Joes and the October Guard that was just astounding. The front and back covers alone for issue 1 and 2 are worth the price. Captain Entropy replied here as well, adding that I mostly remember Diana, D-A-I-N-A, and that is entirely due to Michael Golden. Back to Brett. Finally, That Hostess fruit pie ad was unnerving. Why was Mira's water hand made out of human flesh? How is it shooting fruit pies out of its palm? At least the Manta Men learned the true meaning of fingers and hands and mouths. And the rest of us learned the lesson that fruit pies are gross. Have a Twinkie instead. Well, gotta go. Great Aunt Hazel and Grandma Louise just got into a fist fight on the pickleball court. I thought the shot was inbounds too, but things are escalating quickly. Thanks for all the comments. We're actually going to have more comments, but this time about Paul's fantastic interview with Paul, Paul's podcast partner, pal Paul Levitz. I was the first one to comment because I got to hear it before you guys did. I was so happy I did. And I said, you did such a fantastic job with Paul Levitz. As soon as I heard him say he brought Dunkin' Donuts, I knew it was going to be great. And I actually had no idea about the backstory of Theodore Roosevelt. That really was incredibly interesting to me.
I never made that connection. I knew about his wife and mother dying on the same day, and that's what sent him out west. But I never thought about that in the context of Batman before. That was really interesting.
And I want to thank my Paul for bringing up my very favorite comic story, the Legion Christmas story, with his new podcast partner, Paul, Al Paul Levitz. I loved hearing him talk about it, so I really appreciate that, Paul, my Paul. And of course, hearing the creator of Huntress talk about her was so great. I could really hear the pride in his voice.
Yeah, he definitely warmed up when he started talking about her. So he did enjoy that. So it was great. No, thanks. Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it. We had a good time. Guest of this very episode, Bat Cousin Martin Menza says, Paul and Paul, thank you for having this conversation. I really enjoyed it and how you touched upon quite a few areas that I would have asked Paul Levitz about myself. Like my Bat Cousins, the issue of DC Superstars was a favorite of the time. It was very exciting to be at the ground floor with the debut of a new character like the Huntress. I loved her look and her ties to Earth 2 Batman. She had so much potential that was tapped quite a bit in the years that followed.
Becky749 says, Paul was a wonderful guest and it was a great episode. Oh, and Cousin Jeremy and I brought Avenger-shaped cookies. We couldn't find any Huntress-shaped cookies. And then Bat Cousin Matthew Davis says, well, this episode was a great surprise in the feed. Mr. Levitz, it was great hearing from you. And thanks for all of your work over the years. Your tenure with the JSA and with the Legion in the 70s and 80s remains some of my favorite stories. Unlike Sean, I'm familiar with Theodore Roosevelt's history, but less so with his father's. The analogy between the Roosevelts and Thomas and Bruce Wayne is a great one. Mm-hmm. No doubt TR, who lived the strenuous life and went on to give a speech after being shot, would approve of being compared to the Dark Knight. Now, does that analogy extend to daughters Alice Roosevelt and Helena Wayne? Maybe the rebelliousness, not so much all facets of Alice's life.
My bat pal Dan D made a quick comment. Excellent. Very interesting to hear the combo of the business and the art sides of comics from one person who knows them both, which is exactly how I feel, Dan. So, yep, thanks.
Bat superstar podcaster Chris Franklin says, wow, what a great interview. Fantastic work, Paul K. Mr. Levitz is incredibly humble about his place in comics history. And for me, that goes a long way. It was great to hear him talk about the creation of the Huntress and his time on the JSA and her solo strip. I'm a huge fan of both. And the primary reason is Levitz's writing. I like this take on the Helena Dick relationship too. It's easy for us to forget that relationships like that did happen. I actually feel a lot better about those somewhat awkward pages now. Again, top-notch episode.
Yeah, his explanation that he knew people in his family that were like that then totally resonated, made total sense to me. Our resident bat fashionista, Lizanne Oswald, comes back and says, impressive podcast, most impressive. It was cool that you got Paul Levitz on the podcast. I've been a fan of his for many years. He created a great character in The Huntress and wrote some cool comics in his day. And he did a great job running DC back in the day and definitely took care of the creators when he was there. Paul's two runs on the Legion were pretty cool. Sadly, he didn't make Comic Queen the team leader, but that was one of his few mistakes. It was also cool hearing how he got started in comics and how Huntress was started. Can't wait to hear the next podcast. Thanks, Lizanne.
Future guest, Bat Cousin Captain Entropy says, terrific episode. You ran a great interview, Paul K. I always thought it was great that Paul Levitz proved you could be a great creator and run the company well. And most of all, be decent to your fellow humans. Plus, he always comes across as grateful for the opportunities he received. That's 100% a win, front to back and left to right. The Great Darkness Saga rules.
Well, thanks for all the nice comments, folks. I had a great time talking to Paul, and I was really glad to share it with everybody. If we get any more comments on that, if you haven't had a chance to listen to it yet and make any more comments, we'll check again before next month to post any additional comments we get on that as well. On to social media, Sean.
Now we're going to acknowledge our Bat Family members who shared our podcast on social media. We really appreciate the support from our online community. We'll start with Facebook, and we want to mention Van Z, Max Romero, Chris Franklin, Flavio R. Carpus Souza, Terry O'Malley, Mike Thomas, Herschel Mimas, and Brett Young. Now we're going to flip over to Twitter, and we're going to say special thanks to Outcasters, BATO Podcast, Justice Trek, Michael Thomas, Jeff Owens, The Voice of Paul, Ryan Schufo, Siskoid, Nis.K, Comic Zen, and Rodney Trainum. We also had some really cool Twitter interactions. So when we posted about the episode, Martin Menza himself said, and this is in reference to the 3 hamburgers, the 5 hamburgers, the 6, 7 hamburgers, the 9 hamburgers featured in the episode. Cousin Bob must have been hungry when he was writing these tales. Maybe he needed a White Castle fix. And then when we posted about Paul Levitt's interview, there was that great picture of the Huntress from the Secret Origins special. And Brian Schufo said, "Is that Lightning Lad coming in through the door? Will we find out Huntress was the inspiration for an Earth 2 version of the Legion? My headcanon is a crazy place." Before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows on the network, please consider becoming a Patreon. We are not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount that you can give helps to defray the cost. And we promise not to use your donations to buy tickets to go see a freak show, tickets to a carnival, or tickets to a museum. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts, and thanks.
That'll do it for the feedback section and for both last episode and the Levitt's interview and for episode 7. We had a blast covering our first dollar comic, and thanks again to our special guest, Martin Menza. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us next month as we get 5 stories, including the debut of the Huntress's solo strip, and we reach the halfway point of the Batman Family Reunion.